Drunk Monkeys Twin Peaks Vlogcasting. This is one of your hosts. My name is Colleen Carney Hefner.
I'm Chris Pruitt.
I'm the other host.
Producer Matt.
We run a literary journal called Drunk Monkeys. You may have heard of us. You probably haven't. And it's sister chapbook press Cherry Dress. We've been doing this for a while. However, we took a very long hiatus because we are lazy people. Today, we're going to be talking about The Missing Pieces, which is the supplemental material for Fire Walk With Me, the scenes that have been edited out. And we are joined today by one of my most favorite people, Jared Rivet. And Jared is a writer. He has written episodes of Are You Afraid of the Dark? He has written the movie Jackals. He is a voice actor, and you may have heard him on Earbud Theater. He's a regular actor, and he is in tons of shorts, including two of my favorites, Meet Cute and Motion at Your Door, which he also wrote and directed, where he also plays the pivotal role of the daddy.
Voice and regular.
He is also in the upcoming Asylum film, Ape X Mecha Ape. I am extremely excited for.
All I need is the title and I'm fucking in.
I will literally see that movie 50 times. He is also the host of the monthly Los Angeles-based horror trivia, Dead Right Horror Trivia. Right. He is a very dear and beloved friend of mine. And I am so happy for him to be joining us because I truly cannot think of anyone else who would be better for this episode than unless we got like probably David Lynch himself would not be good for it.
Actually, wow.
Well, we were just talking about.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here. This is really, really cool. I also, when the Blu-ray was done, the entire mystery Blu-ray, actually prior to that, I don't know, at some point I'm in the background of a slice of Lynch. I'm visibly sitting at a table talking with a girl behind David Lynch and all of David Lynch's close-ups. You can see me and I'm a little bit too animate. I'm the extra, I'm the background talent that you hate because I am way too, you know, drawing attention to myself. But they used a lot of my, I was a big Twin Peaks fan. I mean, I'm downplaying when I say big, I was fucking obsessed with Twin Peaks. And I say fucking, is that okay?
Yeah.
Okay.
You can say literally whatever you want.
We will. So
we get vile on this show sometimes.
The producer of the Twin Peaks set was my friend Charlie DeLoza Rico, who's been a close friend of mine for decades. And he had me come in and he had a lot of us come in to do extras at the Bigfoot Lodge where they recorded that bonus feature. It's the one, it's Slice of Lynch. It's the one with David Lynch and Kyle MacLachlan and Machen Amick and one of the kind of associate producer guys whose name I can't remember. But they had also called on me because I had a lot of Twin Peaks stuff. I had the Fire Walk With Me screenplay. I had a lot of the tie-in books and like the trading cards and the weird kind of, they had the Agent Cooper tape. So when you see in the bonus features, those objects, those are mine. Like almost all of those.
I actually almost said that when I, like I had that written down for
it's
the
It's a weird, and then I mean, it's a very strange criteria, but yes. So I'm so excited to be here because I especially, and Missing Pieces, I got to see Missing Pieces theatrically. I got to sit in the row in front of the cast because that was where all the kind of, it was like, we had this one little area for regular people and then they had, the rest of it was reserved for the cast and the crew. So Charlie, when I got there, he's like, hey, sit at the back of this row, sit over there. And I didn't know why. And when I did, it was because as everybody filed in, I had Machen Amick and Peggy Lipton and Miguel Ferrer behind me on my right. And I had Ray Wise and I had it was insane. It was one of those things where I couldn't even move. It was when I knew that they were all right behind me. But yeah, they ran it once and Lynch introduced it. And everybody thought that was when they were going to announce the return, but then they didn't.
Yeah.
And the return was in the works at that time. It was just one of these things where it seemed like the whole thing was built around the idea that they were going to announce the return.
Right.
And he went up and he talked about wood. He talked about carving and, and sawing and making tables and things like that.
That's
and
how
went,
you know it was legit.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Yeah. But that was it. And then they ran the Missing Pieces, which was very surreal to watch on its own, the theater. With Albert,
that's crazy. I wish
Albert Rosenfeld sitting right behind me, and Angelo Badalamenti, But you know,
and
so
now all those people are dead. So
that's the thing, man. They're all
there's the thing.
Yeah,
I can't help but wonder if maybe you had something to do with it.
What?
I hope not. This isn't how you thought this was going to go. You got accused of murder, like, obliquely within the first 5 minutes of recording.
It was. It wasn't me.
Okay. Before we go too much further, I just want to do the Drunk Monkeys info. And I do want to mention that JCO was like going ham on Twitter about how she doesn't like Twin Peaks. And I think that we should get Joyce Carol Oates on the show.
She'll definitely say something interesting or
like
funny.
She
appears to have time on her hands. So.
Yeah, she's had a lot of time.
She does seem to have an awful lot of time on her hands, doesn't she?
But before we get too far into anything, I just do want to say we have a new issue that just got released. We've been on this like end of month release date thing. So our February issue just came out. We are open until the 15th. Of March for all submissions, but especially the pop culture issue, which is our April issue. It's our biggest issue. We love doing it. If you have pop culture related anything, especially One Perfect Episodes, where you talk about a perfect TV episode, or It's Good Actually, where you defend a movie that everybody else hates, we need them. Please send them to us. We are open. We just released Andrew Ketchum's Captiva, which is very quickly becoming the best thing we've ever released because it's already sold like 100 copies. So good for Andrew. That is available through Amazon because it's not up on our site yet. However, you can get both from Amazon and our site directly. Kathleen Allen Conway's Nocturnes. I call her Cat, so I'm like, Cats? Like everyone's friends with her. Nocturnes, which is a beautiful collection. We just closed for submissions, so we'll be announcing some more stuff coming soon. And our March issue will come out towards the end of March, and then we will have our April pop culture issue, and we will be very happy about it. And we took a long break last year because of some mental health issues I was having. However, those are relatively fine now. Not really, but I'm pushing through. So things are fine, and Drunk Monkeys is up and at them, and so is Cherry Dress. And yeah, so if you have stuff, please get it in before the 15th. And if I do not know the pop culture connection, it's not going to get in the issue. Last year, someone tried to argue with me that Christmas was pop culture and was very upset with me when I started making fun of him. So, and that's that. So now we can go on. Now that all that boring stuff is.
The diehard argument has evolved so much that it's now, is Christmas a Christmas movie?
Right.
He's like, well, Christmas is technically, and I was like, I don't know, like Frosty is.
Yeah.
Christmas is not. What are you on about? Okay, moving on. So, I don't know how we want to begin this. I did almost mention that Jared was in that, but I didn't. I thought he would be better at telling the story than I am. The secondhand story. So, we're a spoiler light podcast. We're not going to talk too much about season three, though it becomes increasingly odd to talk about the show in general because of just the nature of the show. And this episode, much like the Fire Walk With Me episode, is going to be less a shot-by-shot discussion and more a sort of chat about the different vibes and esoteric nature and just interesting setup of this whole missing piece. Like, Missing Pieces is an hour and a half long, and it's just shocking. And Jared and I were actually texting earlier because he did let me borrow that screenplay. And it's just, and he was like, how long is that? And it's like 126 pages. And he's like, I don't understand how this is all in there. And I was like, I was thinking literally the same exact thing. Like, where is all this in here?
126 pages, for anyone that's listening, doesn't understand, for a feature, that is not an unreasonable amount. Yeah. It's not crazy. It's, but the philosophy in Hollywood is that one page of screenplay is 1 minute of screen time. And so 126 pages is 2 hours and 6 minutes. The movie's 2:14. I think, is that correct?
That's
so
right.
I mean, it's like, if you were to say, oh, this screenplay equals this movie, that seems, and then, you know, you have stuff where it's like going off and maybe a little bit of a tangent or things going a little slower or faster in terms of pace, why would that be a problem? But the idea that the 126 page screenplay, which contains all of the missing pieces and other stuff that didn't get shot or isn't included, comes out to almost 4 hours, 3 hours and 45 minutes. It's like, how? Why? I don't know the answer to. And I don't understand.
Another Lynchian mystery.
Well, yeah. I mean,
well, it's kind of the Lynch vibe, right? I mean, we're going to linger on things a little longer. Absolutely. Sometimes. So when they're filmed, it's going to. Yeah.
I saw a clip going around on Instagram the other day where it was like some like production assistant is like telling him like, it's like they're shooting something. It looks like it's probably from The Return or something like that. And some production assistant, poor girl, is like, we think the shot ran a little long that time. And he's like, oh, for Christ's sake, who cares how long a shot takes? Getting all like pissy old man about it. So it's like, yeah, that actually tracks. I mean, you know, for one thing, the script probably doesn't say, and then Chris Isaac and the small town cop guy have the slowest and worst fist fight of all time on like 8 minutes long of nothing.
What's fascinating about that scene on the page is that Sheriff Cable. Now, look, Sheriff Cable in the movie and in the script is a very intimidating guy, and he's got the voice and he's got that face and the piercing gaze. And so he definitely comes across as intimidating. What isn't in the script and what is odd about the missing pieces version is when he takes his coat off, he's like this emaciated, like he's got no muscle on him whatsoever. Yeah. And his head is like really large and his head kind of stays in one spot and his shoulders and the rest of him kind of is dancing around. But it's like, it's a slaughter. Like,
yeah.
Chet Desmond is like creaming him.
Yeah.
And it's not even a contest. He's
very slowly creaming him over the course of like 8 minutes.
Beats him almost to death. Okay. First of all, on the page, I mean,
saying creaming him so much. It is Lent. And I have given up being slutty.
But Collins Reddit, I mean, he's supposed to be this, that, you know, Cable bends steel. He's supposed to be this guy. He's a tough guy and he can lift up rebar and bend it over his head with no problems. And like, he's supposed to be, it's supposed to be a contest. It's supposed to be that when they're squaring off that Chet Desmond is he might not, you know, win this fight.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting when he takes his, I'm going to take my coat off, and he takes his coat and his shirt off. And it's like, oh, like, and then, you know, Chris Isaac is buff and he's in great shape. He looks fantastic.
Yeah, he's in incredible shape.
Like, this is a slaughter.
It definitely feels like somebody made a different call on the day of if the script is that much different, because the whole thing is based around this, like, you know, Sheriff Cable's friends, their faces very slowly melting into horror as Desmond just sort of like slowly picks him apart.
They were excited at first too. They were like,
I didn't hate this. I jumped on it because I saw a good bit to go into from the script discussion there.
Yeah,
but
from the beginning.
But it is definitely like, I can see why you took this out of here, because it would have like slowed the pace of the film to an absolutely crushing halt first 20 minutes. But it's a really interestingly developed fight, very interesting choices. Definitely not like the typical way you see a fist fight, like,
you can come back to me on April 1st and I'll tell you what I thought about this scene when Easter has come and gone, and I can go back to be however, I did love his line. This one comes from J. Edgar.
Yes.
It's so funny. I love Chris Isaac. Chris Isaac is how me and Chris became friends.
Yeah.
We always delight in getting
more Chris Isaac content, and at least the missing Chris pieces Isaac do podcast. Deliver on that.
Oh yeah, on everybody, really.
Yeah,
and I mean,
I did a poem, my graduating reading, and then I went to get a soda, and I heard Chris going, "Oh, this girl like read this poem about Chris Isaac." I was like, "That was me." Oh, he tweeted about it, and I was like, "That was me." Mm-hmm. And we became, that's how we
found each other at some point during the residency.
I mean, talking about more of everything, and I think that, you know, what's interesting about that fight scene and about it is that everything is set up. That a lot of the things in Fire Walk With Me, if you're aware of the missing pieces or if you've read the script, there are things that are mentioned or set up, or they kind of come in the middle of scenes and you know that something was being set up, or you know that something has, that they've come in the middle of something that was, we were missing. We just didn't see it. Mm-hmm. And I don't feel like the average viewer, if any average viewer would be watching Fire Walk With Me, but I don't think the average viewer would pick up on the idea that, like, oh, there's stuff missing here. There's stuff that isn't, that like, but those dissolves where there's a dissolve where Agent Cooper is talking and they dissolve into the middle of his conversation. And it's like, what was he talking about? Why are we coming in the middle? Shouldn't there have been a more, you know, a more artful way into this scene? But what's interesting about the missing pieces and about Fire Walk With Me in general is that Fire Walk With Me, decried, maligned, hated, reviled, it got booed at Cannes, tanked at the box office, was and like I'm sure you guys talked about it in the previous episode, but the luster was gone. Twin Peaks had died. You know what I mean? It was not popular anymore.
And well, they planned two more movies, right?
Right. That's
and exactly. Then that was it. Yeah.
Yeah. And yeah. So the weird thing about the missing pieces is that the criticism of Fire Walk With Me when it came out is that it did not reflect the quirky fun of the TV show. It did not. And where is where is Sheriff Truman? Where is Big Ed? Where is Pete Martell? You know, and
it's in the missing pieces.
Yeah, they're all cut out.
So the idea that this, and so reading up on it and just kind of looking at the movie, it's like when you look at the movie, the first, you know, obviously half an hour is like, what the hell is this? But once you get into the Laura Palmer stuff, it's very focused and it's very much about her that last week and her downfall and her, you know, crumbling and realizing all these things. And so the idea that the original plan on paper and in filming was that they would be interspersed with these vignettes of the original cast. And it's like 85 to 90% of the original cast. And some of them aren't in the movie at all, but they were there. Yeah. I think the weirdest thing about watching the missing pieces, for me anyway, is realizing that like Major Briggs is in the next room. Doc right. Hayward is in the next room. When we're watching a scene in Fire Walk With Me, we're like, oh, it's like Donna and, you know, Moira Kelly, Donna and Laura sitting on the couch. And it's like, okay, well, you know, like Doc Hayward and his wife there and Mrs. Hayward there, you know, I kind of miss them. I wish. Well, they're in the next room.
Yeah.
Literally.
Yeah.
Yeah. They're just, yeah, they
and
haven't
I actually thought that too, the scene where they're talking and she's like the phone rings and she's right. Like, oh, I'll get it. And I'm like, yeah. Oh yeah, they're not in that. I don't know. Actually, a lot of me watching this was trying to remember, cause it does fit so well.
Right.
It's like,
yeah.
Like I was like, does, like, I remember this Norma scene, but like, we don't see Ed. We don't right. see Ed, no. You know, right. We don't see Doc Hayward. And I right. actually loved seeing Doc Hayward,
and he has one of the sweetest scenes in The Missing Pieces.
Yeah. I got very emotional watching.
Oh my god,
it's so powerful! And it also drives home the weirdness of the cast swap with Moira Kelly, and like when you're seeing her around the original, you know, parents in that scene, and it like really ups the weirdness factor on it. But then it also kind of ups the weirdness factor on it when you think back and you're like, well, she's kind of divorced from the parental and familial characters in the final cut of the, or the theatrical cut rather of the film. So that's its own weird choice to have made. I spent a lot of time thinking about that. Like a lot of the stuff that winds up on the floor here is stuff that would have seemed right at home as like a random interlude in a random regular episode of Twin Peaks. Like
100%.
The thing with, fucking Josie and Pete and the guy with the coke glasses who blows up in the bank and is in exactly one scene of the television show and they're back, baby. Yep. They're all together and it's like has absolutely nothing to do with anything, isn't even particularly interesting as a scene, and it's like I'm so glad I'm seeing this. And also of course this didn't wind up in the movie, like what the fuck is this? Like
my note for that was Twin Peaks loves its doddering old men.
Yeah,
so many of them.
But it's just so funny. It's like, you know who we need to bring back? The guy who was in one really long scene and then blew up. Like that guy, he's got to be in the prequel. Like he needs to be here.
He was so fun.
What's interesting about that scene, and I looked this up online, and it's you know, again with the internet and with Twin Peaks, you don't know what's the truth, what's not. You don't know if you're getting anything accurate. But based on the script, anyway, that scene was not in the script.
So he flew out Joan Chen for like an unscripted scene. No.
So get this. Joan Chen, Josie, and Harry had a scene together in the script. that was very similar to their scene in the pilot. At the end of the pilot, when he goes to see her, and they're like, oh, it must have been this time last night.
Oh, is that what gets set up at that sheriff's office thing with Lucy and stuff there at the end?
Yes.
There?
Yeah. They didn't shoot that for some reason. They shot the Pete and Josie and the old man thing, which was come up apparently the night before or on the day instead.
Oh, so when she called to say, like, oh, I hear something outside,
he
that
goes
was
out
her
to
getting him.
He goes out there to see her, and they were going to have another scene that was pretty much, it's like different dialogue, but it was like the same kind of scene that you saw in the pilot.
Sneaky.
So I don't know. I don't know where that all came from, but it was just a different idea. He wanted to, you know, I mean, you've seen the making of stuff on The Return, and when he just is like, hey, let's just do this. It's like, okay, just go with it. Just go with it. So that scene was not in the script. There are multiple scenes that are not in the script that are in the missing pieces. And then there are scenes in the script that didn't make it into
aren't,
the
yeah.
Yeah.
We'll get into that.
Lord. I cannot imagine making a movie with David Lynch. Just like, what am I getting today?
Right.
What's happening?
Right. Right. Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think I would be better than Jim Belushi as far as Jim Belushi's response to it, where Kyle MacLachlan has to pull Jim Belushi aside and be like, look, just go with it. Just roll. Because Belushi's like, I don't understand. What is
we're
he
not
doing?
You're
not gonna.
This direction means nothing
to
me.
Don't worry about it. It's fine.
You're saying words, but I don't know what I'm supposed to do in response to them. But he's like, just go with it. It's going to be okay. But yeah, I think I would be somewhere in between. But yes.
I'm trying to think how to do this if we're like, we're just jumping around. So it's like, because there's so much I want to say. I want to talk about that Doc Hayward. Can we just talk about that Doc Hayward scene with the note?
Let's do it.
For a minute. Can we just talk about these things? Okay.
I'm the muffin.
You're right, Donna. I'm the muffin.
Okay, first of all, Doppeldonna, so sapphic.
Yes.
Just make out. Do you want a friend for the rest of your life? Yeah. Like, just. Okay. I'm not a fan of Doppeldonna as much as other people seem to be, but that's okay.
Oh, I had a much bigger crush. I had a much bigger crush on Moira Kelly than I did on Lara Flynn Boyle. So
I understand that.
Yes.
But I don't know. But that episode, I literally wrote, how about me as a friend for the rest of your life? And then gay next to it.
Helpful. good note.
I was being quick, you know. But anyway, this scene.
Very
where,
Chang from Community Vibes.
that's what I was channeling. This scene is so emotional for me. Like, I got like literally emotional watching this. So just to set it up for anyone listening, you know, Laura's losing it. We're definitely jumping around a lot here, and I think that's fine. But she's like losing it, and she goes to kind of talk to Donna, and she starts smoking, and Doc Haywood comes out. He tries to do this magic trick, like so dad coded, and it doesn't work. And he's like, what the it worked in the car, which is crazy because he was practicing it like at the light in the car.
At the light at Sparkwood and 21.
And she starts smoking and he says, why is it that you can't smoke at your house? And I'm a doctor and I don't let anyone smoke in this house, but I let you smoke in this house. And she says, because you love me. And then later he like finds this little notepad. It's like a prescription. He's like, oh, it's a secret message for Laura. The angels will return. And when you see the one meant to help you, you will weep with joy. And, you know, she's like actually losing it. She's like not able to keep anything together. She starts screaming about muffins 3 seconds later. So, but as she's leaving, she like touches, she like squeezes his hand and kisses him on the head and squeezes Mrs. Haywood's hand and like gives her a kiss. And it's just such like a, I don't know, I'm getting like, it's just like such a sweet moment, like for like this woman whose life is just like, her dad calls and says you have to come home, and we don't hear him, but obviously she knows by now her dad's like kind of the one abusing her and her whole life is falling apart. And it's just like there's something to be said about friends, families that like take you in and make concessions for you because they maybe have the feeling, they kind of have a moment where like Doc Haywood kind of just like looks like into the ether, just like thinking. And there's definitely this moment of like, they definitely know something is wrong here. And maybe they don't have the words for it. Maybe they don't know the extent of it, but they, see this person that means so much to their daughter and means so much to them. Like Doc Haywood literally delivered Laura. Like he says that in the show.
Right.
So he's like the first person to see her, really. And like,
right.
It's just like, there's something just to be said. And I think about like all of Aiden's friends that come over or like friends' parents that took me in and like, and like, you know, like gave me some support that maybe I didn't get from my parents, like growing up. And I don't know, it's just like really touching. And like, you just kind of wish like her whole life's so bad. And you're just like, look at this, like one refuse where like she can smoke and no one's telling her like, stop smoking.
Right.
Like there's an earlier scene with Sarah where she has Sarah's cigarette. And she's like, if you don't start smoking, you don't ever have to stop smoking. And those scenes I'd like to talk about later too. But like, it's a different vibe because it's like, we know you're going to do this and we're letting you do it here in like a safe way. Like we're here and we love you. And it's just so sweet. And it makes me sad. That's all I want to say.
No, I mean, for a movie that was, like I said, heavily criticized for being extremely dark, and people called it exploitive. I mean, people were talking about the incest and the way that Laura's objectified and the way that she's, you know, kind of blue velvet humiliated. And you know, it's interesting to see that there was so much heart originally, that there was so much kind of there was care, there was concern. There is a really nice dinner scene at the Palmer house.
Yes, with the Norwegian stuff.
Yes.
Yeah.
I love that scene.
It's really sweet.
It's kind of like the last moment where they're a family, if you think about it. Like a normal family. And he's like, there's my girls. And I'm like, this is awful.
You're right. And that I honestly like there's a few scenes that I wish had. I mean, obviously, I wish that there was a 5-hour cut or a 4-hour cut that we got all of it. But the fact of the matter is, like, I get it. One. Yeah. And if it, not right. I don't want. Yeah.
Fan
yeah.
Cut, right.
Of yeah. And I'm glad to see all the stuff. Yeah. But it is I feel like that Palmer. And it was Grace Zabriskie's favorite scene. She said that the whole learning Norwegian where Leland and them around the table was her favorite scene to shoot. And she was so sad when it was cut out of the movie. But I feel like you need that scene.
That scene was one of the few that I felt like the movie would really be improved by this being in the final cut. Because I feel like, so to me, and we talked a bit about this, like, tonal shift in the movie from the original series in our episode about it, and also how this like kind of skirts on exploitative, how it's very like there's a very have your cake and eat it too thing here, where Twin Peaks is obviously there's no way you can engage in this with good faith without seeing that it's obviously about exploitation, it's about the cycle of abuse, etc., etc. But also there's a little bit of content there that's like, isn't this titillating or isn't this like exciting and stuff, and there's a bit of trying to have it both ways, especially in the movie. But I will say that part of what works for me about the movie is that it feels like another side of the coin than what we see on the TV series, because you know, I tend to think about like the sort of social structure of Twin Peaks as being about this thing of layers, where there is the image of the town that the town attempts to project of like this small town, everybody's friends, they all know each other, we're all quirky, we all do this, whatever. And then there's like this second layer of like the dark underbelly of things that like is inevitable in human society, the drug trade, the, you know, the people that are like suffering with issues that we don't want to talk about, or the broken family issues, etc. And then there's like this additional layer where there's all the like metaphysics stuff and supernatural element and stuff, and how that drives some of the stuff that's going on there. And what's interesting about Laura, and the series will talk about this in increasingly bizarre and abstract and expansive ways as we go into the return, but is how she is kind of the, like, she's kind of the fulcrum that all of this operates on, right? Like, she's in all of these layers at once. She is the person that delivers the meal on wheels, and she is the person who's making the coke deals, and she's also the target of, like, supernatural machinations, right? And like, even she doesn't realize that she's like got her toe in all of these realms at simultaneously, at least not until like the very end. But like, you know, so that to me is what's interesting. And the movie really feels like, especially post the Agent Desmond stuff, it really feels like we get to spend a week in Laura's head and where this was at. And like, everything feels so claustrophobic and so like you know, just racing towards this.
Time inevitable, is running out. Like,
yeah, this inevitable, horrible end. And yeah, like that for me really helps retrospectively drive home. We've gotten all the eulogizing and the mythologizing of Laura Palmer. That's what the whole show is about. That's what the right. show is about again in season three, if you can right. believe it. It's good, but it is about that again. It's like seeing this side of it to me is important for what's functional about it. And I feel like if you're, there's a bit of, if you start going down this road with this Laura stuff and then you cut out to like, let's have like a 5 minute long conversation about how big a 2x4 actually is at the plant. Like, you're kind of like choosing to put the genie back in the bottle for 5 minutes and then be right. like, okay, we're going to open it back up again. Don't worry about it. You know? Right. So you know, it's interesting about like, you know, the well understood phenomenon around how the like tonal shift of this film kind of destroys the franchise for 2 decades. But at mm-hmm. the same time, to me, it's kind of what works about the movie.
Oh, yeah. So,
yeah. That's a hard circle for me to square, but
it is nice to see this kind of happy moment where, you know, with Twin Peaks, the series, we have like Laura as an idea of a person, we get yeah. to know her right. through everyone else, through like right. what Donna says and what Bobby says and what James says, and but like, you know, like it's nice to see, and I think that's why I like the Norwegian moment and I like the moments mm-hmm. with her and Sarah mm-hmm. Because it's nice to see like this is just a family and there's something bad happening. There is this like mm-hmm. sense of like sand pouring out of the hourglass or whatever. Mm-hmm. And I think a lot, I think I've mentioned this before on the show, but I think a lot about like when I listen to true crime stuff or whatever, and I think about how people's lives become reduced to like a timeline.
Right.
So it's like, I think about like, if I were out and God forbid something happened to me and like, what if someone was like, oh, well, this was the last call she made. Mm-hmm. And this was the last time she went to Ralph's, you know what I mean? Or whatever. And it's just like a horrifying otherworldly thought for me that like eventually our lives will be over and then people can say that was the last time we did that. That was the last time she did that. Right. And it's just like a scary thought that I don't like thinking about very much, but then ruminate on because I'm crazy. So I like these moments of like, okay, her time is running out and there is a sense of it and you can feel it when you're watching it. You, especially even these scenes, you can feel like, oh God, like, no, don't do that because you have like no time. like you're going to die like real soon. So I like this, like Leland stomping around, like bring me my axe, like so Fritz-like too. Like, tell me you didn't get Fritz vibes, Chris, from that. Like,
yeah, no, totally. And that particular choice is really interesting too, just because of how the movie like really portrays him as like this extremely fucked up, you know, even in the most generous reading, like a vessel of some sort of like, you know,
ancient
vile thing or, you know, generational trauma or however you want to choose to read what's going on there with the association of him and Bob. But like, you know, then for him to make the ha ha, I'm the big scary monster in that scene is like, oh, that is what? Yeah.
But also they're like,
yeah,
talking. So
yeah.
tell me that's not like, I was like getting real bad, me and Fritz vibes. I was like, get to the fucking point. Stop telling the story. No, he's fine. But anyway, but like, and I also loved these scenes with like Sarah, which I feel, and I've said this before, Sarah is so underdeveloped as a person. Like, she's so important to the story, especially in season three. And Matt, I forget, did you end up watching all of season three? Because he hadn't seen it.
Oh yeah.
Okay, you did watch it. Okay, yeah.
Yep.
I couldn't remember if you finally like watched it just like recently. But you know, even then we just get these weird glimpses of she's like a huge cog in the wheel of it all, but like we don't get her a lot. So I love this like scene of her struggling with the groceries with like a cigarette and she's like, help, help, help. And like Laura is like, can I take the car? And like, you know, there's this weird sort of dance of like, take my cigarette. Now you're walking out with my cigarette. Like, blah, blah, blah. And like this motherly, like, don't start smoking and you won't have to stop, or like, stop taking my blue sweater because I like it and I don't want it to be in your closet. So mom, right? And we don't get a lot of mom with her.
Right.
And then we don't get a lot of dad with Leland because what we know of him is horrific, right?
Yeah.
So, right.
And I think
so
that's
it's just
an
like I
important.
like these moments of of normal. You know, she's going through something, but like think about any teenager going through something, and the mom, like I've been this with Aiden. Okay, I know you're going through something, but can you fucking help me with the groceries for like 3 seconds?
I think that's a really important part of the Leland part of this is that like one of the things that made the reveal in the show so effective is you had Leland as this like broken father who loved his little girl so much that he couldn't stand the idea. But no, he was, you know, the reason that little girl was gone.
Right.
And so in the movie, if he's just a pure mustache twirling pervert villain, then you lose that shock. You lose totally. That full sense of who he was and the idea. And I mean, this we've talked about this ad infinitum, but yeah, why the movie was so summarily rejected was because we don't want to deal with the reality of this.
Right.
This really happens.
Right.
And lovable, goofy dads also do this kind of shit. You know? And
right.
I think you lose that if you don't have that scene in the movie.
Yeah, Cooper has that line in the Tim Hunter episode where Leland dies in season two. Where is it Harry or Albert? I can't remember which one. Somebody says, you know, was Bob a real thing? Like, I don't believe this.
Yeah.
And he says, would it be more comforting to you to know that a father had raped and murdered his own daughter?
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, it's such
and then
a.
They all turn and look directly at the camera.
They're like, well, we don't condone this.
Right, right. But I absolutely agree.
That's saying.
But it's one of the weirder, you know, I mean, it's one of the weirder aspects of Fire Walk With Me and of watching when you see the missing pieces, especially incorporated into it. It's like, it still is a huge question. Who the hell was this for? Other than hardcore Twin Peaks fans.
Yeah.
Because, I mean, that, truly, it was for hardcore Twin Peaks
and
fans.
And that's it.
Yeah.
That was the whole audience.
Yeah.
Was the people that stuck it out through season two because Glastonbury Grove comes. I mean, like, there are things in Fire Walk With Me that you, and they don't talk about it. They don't establish it. That Harold Smith, I don't know who he is. He's some dude that runs the door and clearly they're making out and it's like, okay. And he's got the diary. I don't know who he is. I don't know. And now he's gone. He's not in the movie anymore. So, but the script is that way too. The script is a little bit better. Like, again, as we were saying, some of the missing pieces scenes actually do kind of help to establish things and make things a little bit clearer for the audience, but not much. It really is still just kind of like, nope, you have to have full recall of every single episode of the TV show in your brain, because the next scene might be something that's come completely from episode, 22.
Yeah.
And you don't know, and it's one moment, one little detail.
At a time
like
when
in
that
the
was
90s, you've
got to
be on the
work.
List no. serve or yeah. whatever. You got to be
talked hearing. About this too, where it was like they're asking a lot of their remember I said that we were asking so much of their viewers to remember these things because this was before the internet. So
Wikipedia plot summary.
I couldn't go on Reddit and be like, hey, what did other people think about this?
That hilarious graphic that always goes around on the subreddit where that's like, here's where the bad episodes in season two are. I laugh every time I see that thing. That's so funny.
It's accurate. But it's like they do ask a lot. And
But I had, like I was saying, I don't know if we said it during the recording or if we said it before we started, but I actually had a copy of the script, which I let Colleen borrow. Before I saw the movie. So it was really fascinating
to
me.
Tell the story about how you got that.
Yeah. So I used to live in Massachusetts. I've been living in LA for 30 years, but I was born and raised in Massachusetts. And there was a place in Boston called Pix Poster Seller. And Pix Poster Seller sold posters. But if you went to the back, there was this little library. There was this little kind of behind it, and they sold illegal copies of screenplays for $15. And they had like a little, so they had like, you know, the spines were all up there and it was this huge wall with bookshelves where they just, you know, from floor to ceiling of screenplays, and you could buy screenplays for, you know, Star Wars or anything like that. But yeah, so they actually made that cover. You can see that weirdo photocopied cover with the picture of Laura from the trophy case, you know, the homecoming queen. Yeah. They made that cover. So they would have a little menu off to the side of like the new shit, new movies that were either in production or were coming soon, and they would sell those. But you had to know, you had to ask. They were kind of off menu, so you had to kind of ask for them. So they had Fire Walk With Me, and it's the script that's called Twin Peaks, Fire Walk With Me, The Owls Are Not What They Seem, and The Last 7 Days of Laura Palmer,
yeah,
or something
Fire
like that.
Fire Walk With Me, Teresa Banks, and The Last 7 Days of Laura Palmer.
Right, right. Mm-hmm. So I have that script. So what was interesting is that I read it and read it and read it. I was obsessed with Twin Peaks, and I couldn't believe, you know, that I had this thing. And I also couldn't believe that this was the movie. Like, it was just so bizarre to me that they were being so kind of in the mythology. And then all the prequel stuff is also, and it's, you know, interesting to see the prequel stuff that in Missing Pieces, that there are more holes filled in, that there are more things that we know that she did that the movie doesn't show. And it's like, well, when did she do this? When did she have time to do that? It's like, oh, they shot it. They just didn't include it in the movie. But having that experience, it was really interesting because the stuff made more sense on the page, especially the David Bowie stuff. And then, like I said, when you would drop into the middle of scenes and I knew that, oh, this is only the second half or this is the last third of the scene, but this isn't the whole scene. And it's like, well, so they shot it. So I knew Doc Hayward was in the movie. I knew that Sheriff Truman was in the movie. I knew that Major Briggs was in the movie. And I knew and Josie and everybody else. And it's like, where are they? And so these scenes became very kind of famous. And so David Lynch had made a deal with a French company called, I don't know how to pronounce it, but it's CIBY 2000. They're like CIBY 2000.
Probably, yeah, I don't know.
And it was like the year after Twin Peaks. And he made a 3-picture deal with them. And Twin Peaks was like the big selling point. And so I think originally, and it seems like, again, you go online and it's like, it's either this is true or it's not true. Mm-hmm. The idea that it was going to be a trilogy, that it was going to be a Twin Peaks movie trilogy.
Yeah.
And to me, I buy it because of the way that the Missing Pieces ends, because of the way that the script ends. The script and the movie, the Missing Pieces ends picking up from the end of the last episode, which to me means don't forget about this. This is still important, mm-hmm. and we're going to get to it later.
I thought that those that
well, they did. So you know what?
And
mission
they
accomplished. So.
Yeah.
But it was
I
fascinating.
Thought that those missing pieces scenes with like, oh, I slipped and I hit my head on the mirror.
Right, right.
And then Doc Hay was like, "You should lay back down." I'm like, "No, he shouldn't. Yeah, you're not a good doctor."
Yeah. But
you're
I think
the only
so,
doctor. But so like Lynch, I thought that those were like jarring in like I was like, oh, it's over. And then I was like, no, it's not over because there's all this stuff with
right.
Annie. And
right.
I thought that was very jarring. So that kind of makes sense to me too.
But it was definitely a fascinating time because the ending of Twin Peaks, I don't know if you guys know like what it was like on the day, like what it was like when the finale ran of season 2, but it was a shock. It was like utterly and completely heartbreaking and shocking. And the idea that that was where they left us almost felt inexcusable. It almost felt like this is not, you can't leave us like this. Like this, you can't be telling me that this is the end, that Bob is Agent Cooper and he's going to go on with his evil, you know, through Agent Cooper, through the purest, most heroic man, you know, on planet Earth.
It's a great ending. It's like a wonderful ending. Maybe, I mean, God, I love the return and everything, but maybe just should have left it. You know?
But
I remember my father being very upset by it.
The idea that they actually shot for the movie, these, you know, Annie being wheeled into the hospital and the ring and, you know, Agent Cooper once laying on the floor in the bathroom with the bloody head in the mirror, like they actually shot that stuff. So it's like, oh, they actually meant to keep going. They actually meant to lay down the seeds for future adventures that they were going to get back to this, but they, you know, they had to cut
and
this
they
stuff.
They wanted to do season 3. ABC was the one to pull the plug.
Yeah.
You know,
exactly.
They wanted to continue this.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So the stuff with the deleted stuff, again, the movie was 4 hours long or whatever it was. I've heard rumors of 5 hours, but that's like assembly cut stuff. That's if you don't know the industry, it's like when they say, oh, there's a 5-hour cut, it's like, yeah, and it's unwatchable. Like you can't watch that version.
Right.
The 5-hour cut that was not designed for human beings to go sit in.
Human consumption. You know, not built for human consumption. So, you know, they had to cut it down. He had a contractual agreement to make, I think, you know, a 2-hour and 17-minute or 2-hour and 15-minute movie. Just like Dune, strangely enough. Dune also had that same kind of, you know, constriction on it.
Mm-hmm.
So he had to cut all that stuff. And it was just easier to, clearly, to narrow it down to Laura's, the important moments of the Laura story and focus entirely on Laura and get rid of all of the vignettes and all the stuff with the other cast. If Laura's story isn't progressing, then we've got to get rid of it. And so that stuff was cut and owned summarily by Sibby 2000 that was by this French production company. David Lynch didn't own it. New Line Cinema didn't own it. New Line distributed the movie in the US. So it was owned by and in a vault somewhere in France. Like, and it was something that nobody could get their hands on. And Lynch, in many different publications, including Lynch on Lynch, which I brought up to you guys earlier, is a great book if you haven't read it, Chris Rodley's book on David Lynch. Lynch flat out says he would love to cut that stuff together and put it out, but he can't get his hands on it. It's not something, it's like at the time when they wrote the book, I don't have access to it. I don't even know where it is. It may have been destroyed. We may not never see that stuff, but I would love to cut it together because I want people to see that, which is unusual for him.
Right.
Because he's usually such an auteur and he's usually such an artist. It's like, no, no, if it's not in the movie, then I didn't mean for you to see it. He hates people reading screenplays. He, you know, if you read the screenplay for Fire Walk With Me, or Blue Velvet, or he's like that.
He's mad at you.
Yeah.
He's like you for having done it.
Yeah.
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 So,
and that's why Jared killed all of those people. Yeah,
there you go.
But 20 years later, they managed to get the rights to those things when they were putting together the amazing entire mystery set, which was premature in its titling.
Yeah.
And they managed to get a hold of that stuff and remaster it and mix it. And then Lynch cut it into this 90-minute movie, you know, that doesn't make any sense on its own any more than Firewalk makes sense on its own. But yeah, so that's the origin of that stuff. But to me, that's the indictment that says that, oh no, this really was, I think the three picture deal was originally going to be three Twin Peaks movies. I really
that
do.
That makes sense.
Yeah.
It's funny. It's funny when you watch these, how many of these scenes are like, oh, I am so glad that that got cut because that would have been so stupid.
Sure.
And then so many of the scenes are like, oh, but I really wish you had that. So like that scene of Cooper, like hitting on Diane.
Right. And doing whatever, exercises like, in her doorway.
Yeah, and he's like, oh, the dashing Cooper figured out. I was like, wow, absolutely murder me and like leave my body somewhere where no one will find it.
And yet, that's the only scene in Fire Walk With Me where Agent Cooper acts like Agent Cooper.
Right.
Yeah, I know, but it sucks.
Well, he's a little bit Cooper in that scene where he's talking with Sam Stanley. And he's like...
Oh, there's like the weird milk bath that's being churned.
Yeah, yeah. And he's crystals. Like, you know, Agent Desmond didn't tell me what the blue rose is, and I'm not going to either.
I like how he goes, I cracked the Whitman case. Because, like, you know, in the movie, he's like, oh, he cracked the Whitman case. He's like, I did that. Yeah, if you weren't going to bring it up, I was going to.
It's completely redundant, too. It's interesting. And I like, you get why it was cut. Because it's like, oh, it's a Kyle MacLachlan, Kiefer Sutherland scene. Why would you cut that out of the movie? Well...
Because we don't need it. Yeah,
completely superfluous.
Being annoying.
You don't need it at all.
Yeah, and possibly the most annoying Kiefer specifically has ever been.
Yeah. Other
like at least in that particular way, he's been annoying in different.
I was gonna say, just
other ways.
Him jumping into the Christmas tree. I mean,
you know. I absolutely adore this era of Kiefer Sutherland. I don't even care. I had
it's good.
Him in high school. Yeah. Even Freeway, when his face was all jacked up, I was like.
I will say, talking about those scenes that we get a lot more of the FBI guys and just that little interstitial stuff that's happening between the Desmond stuff and the Laura Palmer main plot that we eventually kick into there. And, you know, other than the Bowie stuff, which is interesting, and I assume we're going to talk about that in some way, but just specifically this thing of, like, Lynch's vision of the FBI is like five weirdos in a room in Philadelphia somewhere just being weird in like a big circle open concept office. It is so strange. It is just the weirdest.
I'm supposed to leave Albert's. I mean, I'm supposed to leave Gordon, who's very important's desk is like surrounded by like Mad Men style, like
just a bunch of like old crap, and he's got this like intercom that looks like it's from the 50s that doesn't work. It's like, the device isn't working. Get me mineral water, and like it's just like. It's always whenever, one of the FBI guys comes in, he's always a huge fucking weirdo. It's like Lynch is so obsessed with putting new law enforcement characters or military characters or whatever in this series, but his vision of what they do or the vision he's expressing of what they do is so strange. Like, like the Twin Peaks municipal law enforcement is like... they're like a fucking Andy Griffith show troupe, right? Like, I mean, it's just like they're just a bunch of like, yeah, well, they're well intended, but they're completely ill equipped to do this stuff. They're just kind of like these happy, bumbling guys. And oh my God, that's why there's a character named Sheriff Andy, isn't it?
Oh, yeah, I was just going to say that.
And he's the most one of those guys. But then, and it's like, and then the FBI is a bunch of like weird Western esotericists, like sitting in a room somewhere, like trying to solve crimes with like psychic powers and stuff like that. What are you trying to say? Like, you've got a guy who's like teleporting through space and time or some shit to like tell you about the ancient entity of evil. And like, this is what the FBI does all day.
I think of a fifth grader wrote an FBI.
Yeah, it's so
also
weird.
The X-Files at that time, right? There's yeah, kind oh, of yeah. like in the air.
Yeah,
the
yeah, no, I and that totally tracks to me. It's just sort of like, I think it doesn't hit so much in the final cut of the movie because everything that's going on is so quick and so chaotic, especially when Bowie comes in and all of that. But like seeing it drawn out a little more here, you get to like take in the scenery and how he's like staged this whole thing a little better. Yeah. It's like, this is very bizarre. Just all the choices made around this.
Yeah, I mean, the Buenos Aires stuff is interesting because like it's one of the many deleted I'm going to take that back. It's one of like two or three missing pieces, deleted scenes that actually is important for the return.
Because
the Philip Jeffrey stuff in the missing pieces is actually really important to the return. It's interesting because in Fire Walk With Me, the theatrical cut, it's not like it doesn't
exist anywhere. It's the thing, like, it exists in no real form. It's like we were talking about like how like the movie is asking a lot of its audience in terms of like, you have to be familiar with the material, you have to understand how this shit all ties together, but it's like the return at points is just like, hey, if you didn't spend like a billion hours online like researching scenes that were never shot and never put together, you don't know what's going on here. And it's an entirely additional level of like, how the fuck are you expected to understand what is happening here?
There was a lot of me hitting up Reddit after this episode of season three, like, what do smarter people remember? Then, oh yes, okay, I was supposed to recall that this was actually somebody else, but also with a different face. Or like,
yeah, but Philip Jeffries, Philip Jeffries kind of being, you know, teleporting to Buenos Aires is really important later on in season three. Is it future? Is it past? That whole conversation that repeats.
We live in a dream.
That whole thing with Cooper, the Red Room stuff, which is clearly post final episode where they're having the conversation in the Red Room about, is it future, is it past? I'm the arm and I sound like this. That whole thing, super important. You know what I mean? It's like, this is crazy important, not in the movie.
Not anywhere.
It's in the missing pieces.
It's in the missing pieces. It's in. You have to purchase one specific DVD set and then watch all the special features on it, and that's how you know what's going on in season three of Twin Peaks.
Kinda.
Not even really. And then you also have to purchase Mark Frost's book that David Lynch didn't even work on. That will be helpful somehow. Don't worry about it.
But the Deputy Cliff stuff and the ring stuff is way more important now. In Missing Pieces, it's way more important in Missing Pieces, and then it's way more important to season three. I mean, the Deputy Cliff stuff is not important to season three at all, but the Deputy Cliff kind of through line in Missing Pieces, it's like, oh, okay, this whole thing with the baby laxative and the drug deal, and that he was much more of a, there was an extra scene with him that's in the script that was not, it's not in the movie, it's not in the Missing Pieces either, where he comes over and gives them shit when they're searching through Teresa Banks's trailer. Because he lives, remember, he lives two trailers over.
Right. Yes, I do remember that. Yep.
And so they apparently shot a scene where, because they were doing a lot of heavy lifting on Deputy Cliff originally. And then I don't know if they realized in the edit or if they realized like, oh, wait, this Deputy Cliff thing never comes back. So maybe we should back off on all the Deputy Cliff stuff. But, Carl brings Agent Cooper to look at Deputy Cliff's trailer. You know what I mean? Like, they keep on making sure that you're not forgetting about Deputy Cliff.
Don't forget Deputy Cliff. It's very important.
Yeah. And then, you know, no baby laxative. That's about it.
Well, and what's weird is... Oh, go
No,
ahead.
go ahead. No, you go ahead, Chris.
I was just going to say, like, the whole cutting the coke with baby laxative thing, like, not like a unique plot point, but it does come in season two under right. completely different but almost echoing auspices with the sort of, like, you know, there's that guy who works for the Mounties or whatever, I'm spacing what his name is, but, like, right. who's involved oh, yeah. in that whole thing in season two. And so it almost reads, like, seeing more of it in here, it's like, was this supposed to reference forward to just the season two stuff? Because obviously right. that was out in the world already at that point. Right. So, I was having a hard time figuring out what the hell the point of all that was.
I do kind of love that scene of Bobby just absolutely losing it, like, flinging the fake coke everywhere.
Yeah, yeah.
That was very fun. And actually, Lita came in. And she was like, what's he doing? I'm like, he's mad. And she's like, he's saying a naughty word. I'm like, yeah, it's okay. Like, sometimes when you're an adult, you say naughty words because and then, you're frustrated.
And in those
fake coke.
In those scenes, you have Bobby and Laura talking about how she has to get the $10,000.
Yes.
I loved that scene because he's like, put this in your safety deposit box.
Yes.
I'm sorry, but a teenager has the safety deposit box that she just right. like Aiden can't find his wallet most of the time.
But it's so important. But the safety, like, the money being in the safety deposit box is so important.
I know right? it is. But it's also, and, to me, I'm like, come on.
Cut out of the movie. There it is. Yeah. Like, they shot it all. You know,
I love that too, because she's all like kooky. She's like, did you kill Mike? And he's like,
right.
Please fucking hold it together.
Yeah. I will say the Bobby stuff, it hits harder with the material that's in the that's in the missing pieces, because that is something that is a frustration for me about the movie, is they have this thing where Bobby kills this guy to, like, seemingly up the stakes in the third act, and then literally nothing comes of it, and it right. nothing ever comes of it ever. And it's like, okay, so why the fuck did we do that? And then right. at least with the stuff in the missing pieces, there's a lot more nuance in the way he and Laura deal with each other, especially that scene when they're in the basement. And it's like, we talked about this, and I think it works okay in the movie, where it's like, you know, the thing where he's like, oh, I realize you don't want me, you just want the drugs. But it's a lot more, like, developed here. And the sort of internal struggle that he's having of, like, he has some genuine attraction to Laura, even though he's kind of a piece of shit in his own way. Mm-hmm. Right. And, like, he's trying to work through that. And right. it's like, that works for me a lot better. And, like, you know, when he's like, he realizes she fundamentally does not give a shit about him, but he walks her out the door, and then his dad is needling him about lighting up a cigarette, but he just killed a guy in the woods. Like, that was like, oh, that this is firing on all cylinders here.
Yeah.
It's like,
he killed
now,
a guy in the woods. Like, his life is so adult, and his dad's, like, micromanaging his.
Right, right. And right. whose dad, who's a character we love, the series yes. teaches yeah, us to love this character, yeah. but it's like, yes. we're also like, oh, this sucks. Like, I hate this.
Right, right, right,
just sitting
right.
there reading Revelation.
Yeah. Yeah, which is, yeah, of course he is. Why would he not be? Yeah.
And, like, Briggs is, like, riveted too.
Yeah. I do like that Major Briggs is consistently season one Major Briggs.
Major Briggs, yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah,
he's totally. Consistently the character that with this very rigid, you know, he's not the kind of guy that we've grown to know and love right. in season two. Yeah. He's the rigid kind of asshole that he is in season one. Right. And I love that. I love that they went back, they made sure, like, nope, this is the version of Major Briggs that he needs to be. Yeah. In the prequel, and not necessarily the guy that, you know, that we care about and worry about and wonder about in
That's
season two.
We call him Robert.
Robert. Yeah. I do think the missing pieces is an interesting window into, like, we talked a little earlier about, like, the David Lynch process and, like, his collaborators and how they respond to that. But, you know, you get, it's all so murky because you get all these anecdotes about how I woke up today and we're doing this scene now that, like, right. nobody has written and there's no plan for or whatever. Right. Yeah. But then at the same time, there is such obvious care in, like, you know, these things are not happening randomly. There is, like, a clear sense of continuity with where this is supposed to be in the story and where these characters are supposed to be at this time. Mm-hmm. He's, you know, again, a lot of apocryphal stories about how much he was or wasn't involved in the season two stuff and, like, you know, how hands off he was for a lot of it. And yet, as has been said elsewhere on here, when he went to make this movie, he was like, okay, I'm incorporating all of this shit back into the story and I'm making sure it all lines up and stuff like that. So it's like, clearly he does give a shit about how this stuff all fits together at the end, even if we can't always make as much sense of it as we want to, or, you know, the method isn't always clear.
There's more season two in Fire Walk With Me than there needs to be.
Right. Yeah, totally.
I mean, it's slavish. You know what I mean? It's like, in terms of, like, well, you've got to have Harold Smith. Well, you've got to have this thing and that thing. And it's like, no, David, like we really don't need Harold.
Like Harold is gone. Yeah.
We're not Harold Smith fans. Oh, actually, we had Hannah Cohen on, and she's like, "Oh, my tender poet man," and I'm like, "He fucking sucks."
Yeah, it's his podcast position that he sucks.
On a child.
Sorry, Hannah.
I love her to death, but she's wrong.
You're wrong about that one.
That's okay. We're all.
There's also, and so one of the things that I talked to Colleen about back when we first started talking about doing the show was that there is a scene in the script. There are a couple scenes in the script with Ben Horn, which were not shot. Richard Beamer confirmed that they were not shot in an interview. He said, no, we never shot that stuff. Apparently, he was unhappy seeing this is, and here we are. He was unhappy seeing Ben doing the things with Laura that we know that he did.
Yeah.
And it was still pretty light. It was still not as intense as Leland raping Laura, you know, in a scene where we get to, unfortunately, have to see that happening.
Right.
But there were two scenes, and one of them is something that is referenced in the missing pieces, which is Johnny Horn's birthday party.
Yeah.
It comes up twice in the missing pieces, and it was a scene involving Ben and Jerry and Sylvia. And I think Leland is there and Laura is there and Johnny is there.
Hmm.
And it's a classic kind of Ben and Jerry Horn scene. And it would have been great. But Beamer, I guess he, because it's interesting that clearly they found out that they weren't going to do it while they were filming, because otherwise they wouldn't have these two or three references to the birthday party.
Right. She explicitly says in that one scene, oh, because I was at Johnny's birthday party yesterday. That felt to me like, oh, there's something we didn't see there.
Yes.
There's no reason to have that callback otherwise.
Right. There's a very kind of Crispin Glover, Wild at Heart moment where Laura says, I was at Johnny's birthday party. And it's like, no, you weren't. And we've never seen that. And there is no such scene. And then I think there's some other scene where like Ben gives Laura cocaine, but she has to do something for him first. And I can't remember if it's like a blowjob or if it's a kiss, or there was something very kind of purient in that she pulls Ben out of the birthday party, or they, I can't remember exactly the context, but where basically she goes to Ben for cocaine.
Mm-hmm.
And Ben says, oh, you know, daddy will take care of you, but you need to do something for daddy, you know?
Right.
And apparently Beamer was like, nope, not doing that.
Cross the line.
Yep.
The Civil War stuff, fine.
Brutal. He just cooked his ass there.
So is that why there was such an emphasis on Johnny's stupid birthday party?
Yeah.
I had a coughing fit.
They clearly thought that they were going to shoot the Johnny birthday party scene because it's in the script and it's a Jerry Horn scene and a Ben Horn scene and all of that. But Beamer said no because he didn't like seeing, he didn't want to play those scenes. He didn't want to be, you know, he didn't want to see Ben. Yeah, it's interesting, the line. But I mean, that's what he says. Who knows what the truth is? The truth is probably somewhere in between. But it's interesting because it did sacrifice. So Beamer making that decision means that Jerry doesn't get to do his scene, that Sylvia doesn't get to do his scene, that Johnny doesn't get to do his scene. So it's
probably better
sacrifice
for that, to be honest.
Yeah.
Johnny stuff is severely problematic.
Right.
Are there any other scenes in the script, since you guys have both read the script, that didn't end up either shot for the film or end up in the missing pieces, other than those?
Those were like the biggies that I remember. Yeah. There's little moments here and there otherwise, but nothing as substantial to my memory. It's missing.
I'm still working through it, so I can't.
Yeah, I think it's just
the
honestly
missing
those
missing pieces.
The missing missing pieces.
There's actually a website called The Missing Missing Pieces, but it's about estranged parents and how they always whine about their kids not talking to them, but they like leave out what they did.
Right.
It turns out they're weird QAnon psychopaths and
read,
it's a crazy
read,
thing
like
that.
I spent a night one night just like in this rabbit, like this woman or whoever made it went through this like rabbit hole of like, what is up with these estranged parents? And it's called The Missing Missing Pieces.
Yeah. But, oh, and then the Harry and Josie. the Harry and Josie scene that never got shot.
Right.
Okay. And again, I don't know what the, it was a scheduling thing. I have absolutely no idea because Harry and Josie do not share the screen in Firewalk with Me. And of course they're not in the final movie at all.
At right. All.
But they are, you know, they did shoot scenes and they're great scenes. And and the Harry, you know, look, the, again, we're talking about season three. There's a scene between Harry and Andy at the police station at like, you know, midnight.
Right.
And Lucy has her freak out
with the intercom
intercom where she doesn't understand how people cannot be in the place that she's
how
talking
they can
to
start
them.
Moving and she doesn't realize right. that they've walked out of the room.
And it's season three they do
yeah,
that.
There's a season yeah. Three. Yeah. Yeah.
It's a running joke in season three that she doesn't understand how people can be talking to her from different places well, that she thinks
that about. Tracks to me because like seeing that scene, it's like this would not really have added anything to the movie, but right. it's one of the best Lucy moments performance wise, yes. maybe ever.
And it's like a little bit.
I don't think I said this on mic, but I had never seen The Missing Pieces until yesterday to watch it. I'd never had access to it before. So this was all brand new content to me, which was very interesting. And I think it's kind of shaping my perspective about how what's bubbling up is like sort of important or feels like it would be interesting in the movie versus what's not. Because it's like even the stuff that is explicitly not that interesting or would not have worked well in the movie is nonetheless interesting to witness. And you know, that was iconic for that. Like the way when it cuts back to Andy sitting in the room, listening to the intercom and you hear Lucy scream over it. It's one of the strangest sounds I think I've ever heard in my life. Like just really amazing stuff there. Like,
right. Yeah,
and then he runs out because of what happened to Lucy, and then, right. and then she's like then she's totally like, confused. Yeah.
Right, and it feels like classic Twin Peaks. It feels like season one Twin Peaks.
Matt, the mad cappery of it all.
Right,
it feels like season one Twin Peaks in that moment. Those moments when season one Twin Peaks feels suddenly like it's a fucking Marx Brothers bit, or like you know something along those lines.
Right.
I want to talk about the extra Norma stuff.
Also,
I
want to
punish myself.
That wasn't in the script, but was shot, by the way.
The Norma stuff?
Norma and Ed in the front seat of the truck.
Oh, okay. I want to talk in the script about the Meals on Wheels thing first, but that.
Yeah, no. But it was another one that was not in the script. That was something that was done spontaneously.
I just want to punish myself. Oh my God, this scene where, so like we get this kind of clip, and in the movie, of course, we get Laura packing up the Meals on Wheels car and the old lady and her grandson approach her with the painting, and it's like, oh, I'm freaked out, I can't do this. And she's like, Shelly, I'm sorry. And you can tell Shelly's like, I don't want to fucking do this with you, which is awesome. Right. It's so catty, I love it. And so this missing pieces scene is like immediately after, and Shelly comes in and she's like, Laura just took off, like her car is here and it's packed up, but she's like, she doesn't want to do it. But what had happened was Ed and Nadine had come in. Nadine sees Norma and has like a fit and is like, I don't want coffee anymore, and runs away like crying. And Ed has to like run after her, and it's like kind of jarring for Norma. And Shelly's like, what should I do? Should I just go do the Meals on Wheels? And she's like, you might as well, because there's no one here. And then there's this echoing of there's no one here. And then Shelly says, if Leo comes, he's not going to believe it. And she's like, I'll take care of Leo. And like, Shelly's like, okay, well, thanks, sweetheart, which is what Norma always says to her. And she like, and then like Norma just sits there and cries for a while. And then Ed comes in and he's like, I'm so sorry. I'll see you later. We can bone it out then. And she's like trying to like be like, oh, I'm so excited to see you. I'm so happy. But then like obviously crying like the minute he turns his back. And it's so upsetting.
Yes. And we get a Heidi chuckle. We get a Heidi giggle.
While she's like bleeding out in the corner or whatever. Like,
I like it too, because she like Norma like touches her arm and she's like, haha. And Norma just has this look on her face like, fucking. I don't
And then I'm like, is this the only time we hear the cook guy say anything? Or
and he's like, I'm slow today. I think it is. But there's this weird echoing of there's no one here. you know, and she's just lonely.
You
and
got
it's
that
like,
big high mounted shot where it's like showing the big empty restaurant. It's like really kind of like unsettling to look at for an extended period of time.
And it's like, like it's like just a beat too long to be normal. So you're like, something's wrong. Like, it is so upsetting. I got so emotional like watching it. I was like, this is so upsetting to me.
It's meanwhile, it's heartbreaking. And then Peggy Lipton, I mean, like the idea that Peggy Lipton got to play that and then got cut almost, you know, 90% of her stuff got cut out of the movie. She's in this master shot. She's in this wide shot and that's it.
Beautiful. And then there's the scene, as Jared said, where they're later, her and Ed do get together and they're kind of like getting hot and heavy in his car, in his truck. They're listening to music. And that scene's actually very creepy to me too, because they're listening to this music and she's like, it's so far away. And then the thought of like someone somewhere playing like sad romantic music, like even just a radio station, and then like you're somewhere listening to it. Things like that creep me out. So, but like, you know, and he's got like a breathalyzer and he's like, Harry gave it to me.
I love the thing that the sheriff gave me a breathalyzer. Like, no, a court ordered you, Ed. That was not like a thing he let you borrow. That was so funny.
She says they're one big great smash up.
Right.
My heart.
I know.
Just that real like Romeo and Juliet Dire Straits stuff where it's like the time is wrong.
Right.
We could be great, but I mean, you know, no spoilers, but we'll come back to them.
Fortunately, I think we'll hear a little bit more from Norman.
But for now, where if we are to pretend that this is it for them, it's heartbreaking. Like, I was like literally in tears. Like, and I'm just like, why am I crying over these people?
Yeah.
I mean, I'm always crying over Peggy Lipton, but that's okay. But
as are we all.
That. Yeah. Just such a tender thing. And I love her. Just like with the little Sarah Laura scenes, or Laura with Donna's family. I love how she takes care of Shelly. Like, she genuinely cares about Shelly, and she knows that Leo fucking sucks.
Right.
And she's like, you do not have to worry about it. I will fucking take care of him.
Right.
And like, I just love that kind of like motherly bond for her. She's a coworker, but she's not just an employee to her. She's like a daughter to her. And we see more of that later moving forward. So anyway, I just wanted to be sad for a minute.
there's also a supremely creepy, very kind of Inland Empire / it's kind of got some of the Return in it, but it's very Inland Empire, where Laura is kind of seduced by Bob in the stairway.
Yes. Is that manipulated, that face she's making, or is she just slowly moving her lip? Because I watched it like 4 times and I was like, I cannot honestly figure out.
It's fascinating.
Yeah, I can't figure out how her mouth starts grimacing.
I don't know.
If it's like the Inland Empire Laura Dern thing, or if it's just...
I don't know. They're doing something weird. And then also the missing pieces also spells out a geographical thing about the Palmer House that I never noticed before. And I don't think that you get it from the TV show at all. And the TV show, it was a set, so it's hard. You know, other than the pilot, the interiors of the Palmer House would have been filmed in Van Nuys. But... there's that weird MC. I don't know if you guys noticed it.
Let's go.
Watching the missing pieces. I don't know if you noticed, but the staircase, it's this MC Escher thing where you can go upstairs from two different places in the Palmer House.
Yeah,
it
looks crazy. Yeah.
Yeah, I did notice that.
And there's a landing in the middle. Like, there's like a half floor where there's like just this spot where the two staircases converge.
House of Leaves shit.
It's very weird.
Absolutely.
And you don't see it on the show, and you don't really see it in the Fire Walk. And you see people going upstairs in different places, but you don't see this bizarre, and it's so Lynchian. But I think that's just the house. I think that's just because they shot Fire Walk With Me was shot in the original location.
In the house.
Yeah.
Interesting.
The lady who owns the house is on Twitter. I should be like, hey, let me see that staircase real quick.
Hook me up with that staircase.
That
whole scene is really good. It's like so much going on with it, where it's like we have that constant repetition of the like ceiling fan shot or whatever, but like there's this real sudden meta moment where she's caught by the shot, you know, and then like that incredibly creepy face thing. I don't know what the balance on the practical versus digital versus whatever the hell was going on there effects right. were, but I was also wondering the same thing, because you can see her eyes dilating in and out really intensely, yeah. and it's like they're clearly passing a light over her face, mm-hmm. so it's like maybe mm-hmm. they're actually doing that, but I think it would be very hard to keep your eyes open through that process yeah. as long as she does. It's very strange looking, and yeah. then it leads directly into that thing where Sarah asks about the sweater again.
She's wearing
and Laura's like, "You're wearing it," or right, whatever. Right, right. What are you wearing?
What are you wearing?
Yeah, what are you wearing?
Which and is then, so teenager.
And, yeah, and then yeah. Sarah like starts freaking out because she's like, "Oh, I didn't realize this. Oh, I'm forgetting it's things again." Yeah, yeah. Right, and it's right. like, and we know what that's about with the yeah. whole Leland probably drugging her somehow or whatever. Right. And it's like, oh my god, it's yeah, like so yeah. many. Like, I'm so upset right now.
Yeah. it's so very upsetting. Things. And I thought that Laura, I thought her performance there, where really she's good. Like, "No, mom, it's not," and she like shifts right out of being hypnotized or whatever into like, "I need to take care of my hysterical mother." And yeah. There was something. She it's very quick and it cuts quick. And she's yeah. like, "No, it's not happening again. Sit down." And the way she does it is mm-hmm. so good. It's like such a good line read. And I'm not an actor, and I'm not mm-hmm. a writer of these types of things as much as I would like to be. So I don't really understand why I think it's so good, yeah. but the way she says it is so shifting into this, like, because, you know, there's a lot to be said about Laura. She's a child, really, but she right. lives this very adult life that's very hard. And it's just like this parenting of her mother, this parentification of her. Right. And she's like, "No, it's not. Sit down." And she's taking control of the situation. I just think the way she read that line was really good. And I wish there was a little bit more of it. But maybe yeah. because there wasn't, that's why it's so good. You know what I mean? Well,
I mean, you get, yeah. Sarah almost seems like there's a lot of gaslighting going on, because Leland knows that she suffers from mental illness, that she's clearly, the implications in those deleted scenes is that Sarah at some point had a mental breakdown.
Yeah, that's what I picked up from it too. Something weird.
And that Leland has clearly been like poking that and using it, you know, over time.
Yeah, it's hard to tell exactly like what happened in her past that we don't know about.
Right.
And then what happened, like what, like, you know, like, because we know that he's drugging her a lot and stuff, like that's been implied in series. And poor Sarah. I wish we had more of Sarah. That's like the biggest regret I think I have with the show.
Yeah.
I think Sarah is just such an untapped person. Do you know what I mean?
And not to say much about season 3, but even then, that's just more questions. Just a lot more fucking questions.
My major question there, not to be a little, I know I said spoiler light, but my major question was, is that the handy market? And it was. So, in her main scene in season 3, I was like, "I know the handy market, like the back of my hand." And it was, and I was very proud of myself.
I'll say about what you mentioned about the performances in that scene, I think particularly Cheryl Lee's performance there, I think part of what works so well about it is that, you know, so much of this movie is about like Laura's like disintegration and like obvious heading towards everything falling apart, but she's in the position she's in because of the variable expectations on her and the constant need to be gear switching and so on. So to watch her in that moment react to her lashing out at her mom, seeing her mom get upset, and to be like, "No, I have to go back to this mode of being the responsible person, looking out for somebody I shouldn't have to look out for," even as she is like clearly on the like downward spiral, right? And because she is, you know, not to overstate it, but because she is so effective at playing that like extremely broken, extremely hysterical like element of that character at times, that like when you see her shift into like, "No, I've got to hold my shit together right this moment," it's like you feel it immediately in her performance. So it comes across really strongly, I think.
Do we want to talk about the stuff that got cut out with the flesh world stuff? Teresa and
the blackmail.
I think it's interesting what they cut out.
It is interesting what they cut out.
Yeah.
So just to kind of set it up a little, it does show Leland calling Teresa from her ad in Flesh World. Which I still like die over the Flesh World.
Yeah.
What's this magazine about? And he like sets up this meeting that we know from the movie to be like, he's supposed to have this hot and heavy threesome with Renette and another woman. And the other woman is Laura. And he sees her and he's like, fuck this shit. And he like leaves.
Right.
But you know, it has this scene of him calling her and she kind of sets it up and stuff. And then it kind of has that kind of flashback to Laura and Renette on the bed, and it doesn't show him leave, but Renette, like, it's like Renette joins them and is like, oh, the guy ditched, so it looks like it's just us. And there's this like kind of heavy implication that they maybe, you know, fuck around with each other. And Teresa has the ring on. And then later there's even another scene where Teresa calls Jacques and is like, hey, what does Renette's dad look like? And he's like, I don't know, he's like a kind of fat bald guy or whatever. And she's like, okay, well, what does Laura's dad look like? And he's like, oh, he's like super handsome, like movie star handsome, which I thought was a little overselling Ray Wise. And you know, I love Ray Wise.
I'm sorry, did you just say overselling?
Yeah, Ray Wise? I disagree.
I love
Ray.
I know, strong that's disagree. What I mean. That's what I mean, though, because you know I love Ray Wise. Right. But I thought, like, come on. Right. Yeah. But then she's like, oh, you know, like this guy ditched us. So she got JB'd. And I'm like, what the fuck does that mean?
But yeah, I didn't know what that meant.
I actually even looked it up and somebody was like, I think it means ripped off. And it's like, okay, whatever. But I got, you know, like ditched by this guy. So I had this kind of theory, but this guy was very tall with like a broken nose. So I'm to assume that she saw Bob, right? When she was supposed to be seeing
I thought that too, but what I took is that she realized Leland was Laura's dad and that she was right. Just saying what she said to throw Jacques.
Oh, yeah. To throw Jacques. Like, okay, see, I didn't pick that up. That
because
makes
I thought
more
then
sense.
The point of her then calling him back is that she could blackmail him. This
yes. Oh, okay. Right? So absolutely. See, that makes sense. That went over my head.
100%.
And,
yeah.
I think that's what we're supposed to intend. I mean, I think that like the way it reads in the theatrical cut of the film is just that he realizes Laura's involved with this girl and he lashes out and goes and murders her. But I think what we are finding out in the missing pieces is that there's a way of reading this that's almost like he gets sort of blackmailed by her and
okay.
then he resolves that
by
going and killing
by going and killing her. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's on me. But to be fair, during this scene, Lita kept going, mommy. And I was like,
it's an interesting, you know, and when you get into the whole prequel kind of thing, it's interesting because it completely retcons the context of the Teresa Banks right. murder.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it is. He has to go and take care of this because she knows who he is and that's dangerous.
And I hate talking about this shit because it's like kind of the least interesting stuff about the show and yet also somehow the most discussed part of the show on the internet. But like you know, it seems to suggest some things about the metaphysics stuff, right? Like she has this ring on. She is suddenly this like crafty player who's like, you know, drawing out people's secrets and like trying to take advantage of them. It's like, it's interesting to see like, you know, is she ultimately somebody who's caught up in these like, you know, mystical currents of whatever the fuck is supposed to be going on in this place.
Right.
Yeah.
And the ring stuff is much clearer in the missing pieces than it is in the final film. And the ring stuff is interesting to me. I'm a horror guy, as we've already said. But I love horror anthologies, like my favorite. And there is a horror anthology called Black Sabbath that was directed by Mario Bava. Mm-hmm. And depending on which version you see, it's either the first story or it's the last story. I can't remember exactly which order, but it's two different versions. There's an American version and an international version. Mm-hmm. But the story that I'm talking about is called The Drop of Water. And in The Drop of Water, there is an old woman has died. She was a witch and a fortune teller. And this woman is called they knew she was dying. She's on her deathbed. She has expired. And they call in this woman to basically come over and take care of her for the arrangements for her funeral. So they've got like a dress and they've got, you know, stuff she needs to make her up and take care of her. So when the woman gets there, the dead woman is wearing a ring and the woman wants it. And she steals the ring and it leads to all of this horror. It leads to, and I mean, it's absolutely terrifying segment. It's a fantastic, it's moody and very, you know, gorgeously shot and lit. You have to see it. But there's a line of dialogue that comes up in season two that is from Black Sabbath. And it's like, oh, okay. And then this ring thing where at the end, so at the end of the Black Sabbath, spoiler alert, at the end of the Black Sabbath segment, the woman has died of fright who has stolen the ring. The cops come and they're like, geez, look at her face. Like, it looks like she's, you know, just, we can't find a cause of death. And she's got this dazed, terrified, wide-eyed, open mouth expression on her face. And one of the cops looks down and says, huh, look, it looks like she was wearing a ring. I wonder where it is. And a woman in the crowd kind of backs away and is like, oh, I don't know what you're talking about. And she's wearing the ring.
Ring? What ring?
And so it's going to continue on. And okay. So it's interesting because in the missing pieces, we literally get an adaptation, a homage to that scene where the nurse steals the ring.
She does like a little thing. She gets sassy with it.
Yeah, she got a little zesty with it.
She's like, got her best 90s hair. And she's like, I've been watching a lot of 90s erotic thrillers. So I was like, oh, okay, that makes sense.
But it's fascinating.
What
that
was
the
line that was in season
one? Oh, Wynda Merle says, no, Leo, I prithee. He's got the shock collar remote.
Oh yeah. We love that stuff.
Oh, no, Leo, I prithee is in, and she means it in the Black Sabbath. She actually, the thing is coming at her and she said, no, I prithee. But it's this beckoning to not be heard.
Right, okay.
But I'm fascinated by because the ring is entirely new from Fire Walk With Me. Right. Yeah. The ring there is mentioned. So there is a ring in season two, right? The giant where the giant takes and gives.
Right. Not the same ring.
Yeah. Not the same ring at all. And the Owl Cave ring doesn't show up or figure into anything in season one or season two of the show. Mm-hmm. But all of a sudden in Fire Walk With Me, the ring is like this key component of everything.
Yeah.
Agent Desmond disappears grabbing it. And it's, you know, clearly it denotes who the next victim is going to be. And then the little man, Mike, says, someone else has it now. Where is the ring now? Someone else has it. Mm-hmm. And so it's interesting to see. And then the ring, you know, spoiler alert to a degree, the ring figures very importantly into season three.
Right.
So it's interesting that this ring thing is both present and accounted for and creepy as fuck in Fire Walk With Me, but that there's more of it and that you actually get a much better sense of what the ring means and why, what its purpose is, what reasoning.
That nurse, there. I would like to think the nurse like took in and like went home and just like did something awful.
It's, you know, the way that she's
I'm gonna turn into a huge jerk now.
But the way that she's excited about the ring and stealing the ring is very reminiscent of Black Sabbath.
That's so fun. I'm gonna watch. I've never seen that.
Spoilers for 1960s anthology horror film Black Sabbath. Tag the episode description with that.
Boris Karloff is kind of the crypt keeper. He does the interstitials, but he's also the star of one of the segments. It's fantastic. It's really, really great. And I actually prefer the American cut for the score. And I don't know. Anyway, moving on. But yes, the ring. I find that the whole ring thing to be really fascinating and really, and it's something that is really important to Twin Peaks mythology, but was clearly not conceived as a, you're talking about retcons. You know, you're talking about the Leland retcon. And some of the stuff that is retcon, there's a lot of retcon in there. And then, you know,
we've talked about a lot of the retcons.
It's also interesting in that there was that book. There was the Agent Cooper diary, the book, the biography of Agent
Cooper.
That's
the only one I haven't read.
And so the Theresa Banks investigation is entirely different
in
that book. Really? Yeah.
We're going to do a book episode. So I'm going to have to dig that up.
Yeah.
I mean, as it stands, the Cooper stuff in Fire Walk With Me, I mean, the Agent Desmond stuff is supposed to be Agent Cooper. So, I mean, the whole, you know, spilling the tea insider thing is that they wrote the first draft of the script for Agent Cooper. And they were like, okay, well, if we do a Twin Peaks movie, we've got to have Agent Cooper in it. So they gave him the Theresa Banks investigation. He was there. And when they went to Kyle MacLachlan, MacLachlan said he didn't actually want to be in Fire Walk With Me. Flat no. Hard pass. So Chet Desmond is created. Then MacLachlan,
thank God, honestly.
MacLachlan changed his mind or had some kind of a conversation with Lynch where they met halfway and McLaughlin said, I'll do a couple days on it. Not much, but I'll come in for just a brief bit. And they had already, I think, cast Chris Isaac as Chet Desmond. So it actually complicated the things a great deal.
Of course he did. That doesn't surprise me at all, yeah. Actually.
So the Agent Cooper stuff is just kind of there, A, to make sure that there's some Agent Cooper in the movie. But, you know, B, it was supposed to be him for the first half hour, which, if you think about it, makes all the sense in the world.
A great
it
deal makes more sense.
Yeah. Yeah. And certainly what reviewers were saying at the time.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's especially the way that they resolve it in the film, like the theatrical cut where he just goes there and he's like, yeah, I don't know. I'm just seeing all the stuff that Agent Desmond saw and I can't really figure it out. Don't really know why I'm here.
Necessary and
see you later, Diane. So click.
Yeah. Yeah.
Diane, you look hot today. Bye.
Yeah,
right. The idea that he's there to investigate Chet Desmond's investigation.
Yeah, yeah. It was just like so absurd.
Yeah.
But it does, you know, that does, like, I kind of knew about the inside baseball about that. Yeah. I remember the thing I read about it was that Kyle was like concerned about winding up being typecast from playing Cooper too long, which sorry about that, Kyle. Sorry about how that worked out. Ultimately,
he hasn't come to embrace that.
Yeah.
And good for him. Love that. But you know, it is pretty funny with like the whole thing of, well, we didn't bring Chris Isaac's character back because we couldn't figure out how to get him back from wherever we took him. It's like, I don't know. You brought all these other characters.
Right, yeah.
I think you just didn't need him because he was an extraneous character the entire time he was in the series.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, that's a whole season three conversation that I guess we can't have right now. But, I do wonder.
I do bring up the we couldn't figure it out. And I'm like, when we get to see
we've talked about that because, we've already laid that in there because it's like, you know, we're just mad about Chris Isaac not showing up.
I want Chris Isaac personally. To be around all the time. Yeah.
I won't say their names, but there are five or six characters that I wish they had dealt with in season three. That I don't know why not, you know,
right.
Obviously there's politics and personalities and, you know, money and who knows what other reasons there could be, but like
a lot of people aging.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 And some of them were dead. You know what I mean? That doesn't,
that one's a real challenge. You got to get the, like,
is it nowadays though? Not really.
Yeah. You got to get the like Grand Theft Auto 3 graphics, Tupac hologram of these guys. In there.
I'm looking through. I hope you guys cannot hear that. There's like two car alarms going off outside.
Can't hear it.
No,
I cannot. Yeah. So
now that you mention it,
I'm kind of going through the things we haven't talked about, and I don't think that there's very much that's super important. Laura,
there's definitely an extremely important insert shot where, and I'm joking, but where the log lady is just like receiving bad vibes while Laura is being murdered and stuff. Well, it's just I like the shot. It's
she
just
can
funny.
Hear Laura dying.
The screen,
it's
right?
But it just shows her kind of go like,
but she's sad.
In the script, if I remember correctly, and I guess you haven't gotten to this part of the script yet, Colleen, but in the script, it's in the script that the log lady is suffering as she's psychically being fed that she knows that Laura's being murdered. But it also says that her owl cave tattoo is glowing.
Oh,
that should have been in there.
I know.
Somebody didn't add that in post. They realized it wasn't making it to the cut. Like, forget it. It's done.
It's interesting, but she like reaches down because it's hurt. It hurts. It actually burns her. And I don't know why that isn't in there. But yeah, it's an interesting cutaway. And I think that, you know, Lynch just loves Catherine Coulson and just clearly wanted
that is understandable.
You love her.
Any more Catherine Coulson is not a bad thing.
It's just that I'm not sure I needed the backstory when she shows up in season one and is like, I received bad vibes that evening. It's like, no, I got it. She received the bad vibes.
Right. But you know what's interesting? Because you guys also talked about Waldo, the Mina Bird, in your previous episode.
We love any reference to Waldo. We're
a big Waldo fan.
The inclusion of Waldo in the recreation of the murder at the end of Fire Walk With Me, but then also the Log Lady. There's stuff that's there because it needs to be.
Right.
You know what I mean? Or stuff, and obviously they cut it out.
Right.
In the case of the Log Lady.
Because it ultimately didn't need to be. But
right. But when they go and visit the Log Lady, that's the thing, is like there are certain things like the Dr. Jacoby scene. It's like there are certain things like, no, you don't understand. you know, to the whoever's writing it or whoever's making the movie, like I'm talking hypothetically, no, no, we have to have Dr. Yeah. Jacoby have this phone conversation with her. We're listening to the tape. We have to have the log lady because she said that she heard.
She said she's in there. Yeah. Right, yeah. Right. You know? Yeah, totally. Yeah. You can see the backwards working on that.
Yeah. 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 Mm-hmm. You know?
I took screenshots of the Jacoby, like he's like, give me a kiss or whatever. Right. And Laura's like, like makes like the worst face.
Yeah,
they actually took screenshots and then tweeted it because I was just like, yeah.
Even though it's not useful or doesn't give us anything we don't already know, the Jacoby scene was really one of those great blurring of the lines Jacoby scenes where it's like, I cannot tell to which degree this guy is just a creep or he thinks he's doing the right thing, because it's clearly some of both. But like how much, which part of that personality is winning out with him? And you never really know.
Right.
I'm going to say something crazy and controversial.
Yeah.
I believe that Jacoby and Paul Kinsey from Mad Men are cut from the same cloth. I get vibes. Each time I watch either, I'm like,
You're receiving vibes like Margaret Lanerman is.
I'm like, vibes. I'm like, anyway. So, the Jacoby thing I thought was like, okay. I love how much we could talk for an hour about how much Coke she just hoovers into her face.
A lot of that.
It's like me 15 years ago.
It's like Tony Montana level.
She literally has the little bag and she just sticks the thing right in. I'm like, I used to do that.
Like how much prop Coke did Cheryl Lee like wind up snorting during the course of that like filming process? That
talk
had to be
about exploitive. There's that one scene with her in the car with the guy and she's like, you drive this stick shift and I'll do this one.
Right. Yeah.
Kind of hot. I'm not supposed to think that, but
yeah.
Well, but I do.
I think you are supposed to think it a little bit. I mean, I think that comes back to the having it both ways kind of thing.
That's but that's what I mean. There. Like, I should know better.
Yeah.
Plus, it's Lent. I gave this up.
Well,
for Lent.
And then they firmly establish the whole driving to Canada thing, which is not in the movie
there's
at all.
There's thing like the Canada.
I will say that was that might be the thing that worked the least for me in the missing pieces, because in the show, in the theatrical cut, it almost just seems like they step into a back room of the roadhouse.
And, that's what I thought it was.
It's too. Like at the very least, we don't see that transition. They're just kind of immediately there. They walk in a door and they're there. But I think the insubstantiveness of that, or whatever word I actually want instead of the fake word insubstantiveness, is that like that to me is part of what works about that scene, because it's clearly like a call to like the Red Room stuff and so forth. And we're seeing that there. So the fact that it's not like real clear, or it's kind of like that they're just suddenly arrive in this place, like that to me works about it. This whole we need to have like a drunk driving sequence, and then like Laura berates Donna again, which we see her do like two or three other times in that same sequence. It's like
it's a very Blue Velvet. It's a very Blue Velvet scene.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's true. And you know, maybe it makes sense in that regard, but it just very feels like if that goes by quicker, that's a better scene, you know? Yeah. Like that to me is like,
if it's not rooted in a reality, it's interesting, because it's like, is this actually happening? Like, like it's otherworldly and dreamlike, which is what nights like that can be sometimes.
And very like playing into the fact that, like, you know, at that point, Laura and Donna and all these people are on some combination of drugs, alcohol, etc. Like the idea that this is all happening in like a haze that's just kind of mysteriously going by, like feels very, again, it feels part of the whole, we're kind of in Laura's head with the way the theatrical cut of the movie works. And this would be one of the things where if this were late into the film, I feel like it would take me out of it a little bit. Sure. But plus it's got that For the Power and the Glory thing that is clearly like trying to make fetch happen in deleted scenes. And then at some point it was clearly decided, nope, we don't care about that.
It's not a thing. It comes up two or three times, right?
It comes up at least twice. It's in that trucker scene that Colleen was just talking about. And it's on the doorway to the club or wherever it is they're supposed to have wound up.
Right.
It's the Fidelio of this movie. Like, what's the secret password? Right. Like, stop.
But I don't think that ever comes up again anywhere else. Like, it's only self-contained in these scenes. So clearly at some point it was like, yeah, we don't need
this
that.
This is bad. Who thought
right, right, right. And they kind of solve the problem in the theatrical cut. There is a point in the subtitled club dialogue where somebody says, "Welcome to Canada."
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I didn't even catch that.
I think Laura says it to Donna. I'm not 100% sure. I can't remember off the top of my head who says it, but it's like the first sub, they come into the door, they know the pink room music is there and the lights coming in, and then they walk in through a doorway, and Laura, I think, turns to Donna and says, "Welcome to Canada." And that's it. But again, just like anything, especially in that scene, anything that they're talking about, anything, they've crossed a border, they're in... Right. They're in their own red room. They're in their own black lodge, and whatever it is that's going on, like, it's not meant to be taken literally. I'm the great Wentz, you know, all this stuff.
They're in a liminal space, and it's actually liminal space, and not the way people on Twitter who don't know what that word means say it. It's a picture of a mall. It's a liminal space.
Right. It's like a picture of like a tennis ball in a field. They're like liminal. You know who hates that is Kia. You know Kia. You know, the poet that we've...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Yeah. She's like, that's not limited. Like, she's like, get offline, girl. Like, it's okay.
But in terms of crossing borders, I there's a fascinating kind of... And it's just like a non sequitur. I don't even know where... I know where it goes in the script, but like, I don't know. The scene where Philip Gerard, or Mike, the one-armed man, is trying to gain access... to the red room with his circle of candles.
Oh yeah,
it's backwards. So he's like,
and he's saying,
"Fire, I'm lighting that." That's pretty cool.
That was a cool scene.
Yeah. It's such a cool scene, and again, it doesn't really
doesn't do anything.
Doesn't do anything. It totally can go. It needs to be. You know, you can cut it. But
it looks cool though.
Yeah, you get there's because Mike is such a mysterious figure in Fire Walk With Me because you don't. I mean, I really don't understand what he's trying, what side he's on, what he's trying to accomplish in that. Right. I mean, he seems to be kind of anti-Bob and trying to stop Bob, but at the same time,
he's like a reformed Bob. So
but he also wants access. He wants access to the red room. So he's like, at one point, he's doing the ceremony and he's sweating and he's going through withdrawals of some kind. Like, he hasn't gotten his Garmin Bosia in enough time. And
hate when that happens.
And then
I hate when I can't have my Garmin Bosia.
Yeah. And then he seems like he waits for Leland Bob to kind of activate the access so that he can get in. Like, I don't know. There's like a whole kind of sci-fi aspect to you know, Philip Gerard's whole thing is in Fire Walk With Me.
And it feels like he's trying to take advantage of whatever is happening between Bob and Laura as like his access point to this or whatever. Yeah. Yeah.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep. Absolutely. And it's an interesting, and like I said, it's like on its own, it's really fascinating. And they did this thing and they filmed it backwards where all of the candles are lighting as he's touching them. Right.
Yeah, and then he's unlighting. Yeah,
unlighting.
Unlighting them. That's interesting.
Yeah. It's fascinating, but again, when you just see it, it's like, okay, that's weird. But if you think about what we just discussed, it's like really is. He's spending that whole movie desperately trying to gain access to the red room without having to team up with Bob, without having to help Bob, without having to participate in Bob's activities, and he throws the ring into the train car. Brings about
while Cooper is like, do not, hey, Laura, don't take the fucking ring. Don't take that ring. Yeah.
Right. You know,
there's a lot to say about whether or not he could have actually saved her. I don't think we'll talk about that more in season 3.
But it's like, there's also something so perverse that says about Cooper that is really interesting to me because it's so much clearer in like what's with the additional context we get around it with the, with these deleted scenes, because you know, I understand like the ring is bad in the theatrical cut, right? And as you've also said, we get more context about that shit much later. Yep. But in terms of like here in the 90s, and we're seeing this object for the first time, you have introduced it, this MacGuffin, in this movie, right? And in the theatrical cut, it's really unclear like what is happening when Cooper is like, don't take the ring.
Right.
But it's like, you know, seeing it with this additional context is like what Cooper is saying is don't ever get murdered in the first place. I am manipulating time right now, or I'm trying to and failing. Like, and that to me, and this, this is going to be helpful to talk about when we're talking about The Return. I don't want to go too far down this road, but this is going to be helpful to talk about what Cooper's whole fucking deal is in the Return season. And this is so much clearer to me now. Again, I've not seen this until literally yesterday.
Right.
And it's like, it's filled in. It's filled in some lore for me.
Yes.
Deep in the lore now, Chris.
Yeah.
That's a thing.
I like it. I just don't think it's that interesting to go like, what are the exact, like if I equip the ring, does it give me +5 strength or whatever? Like, that shit is not interesting to me. But the like how this stuff fits together in terms of what it's saying about morality and you know, metaphysics and stuff is interesting to me.
But all of the post final episode stuff, and in Fire Walk With Me, you're not 100% sure if it's post final episode in the missing pieces. Mm-hmm. It absolutely is. Yeah. It's Cooper in the lodge. Post final episode,
right?
And what you start to realize about the lodge is that time doesn't work the same way. It's not linear. You can observe things, and then in season 3 we get to see this even more, you know, kind of blatantly. And he's desperately trying to manipulate the situation from the future to stop things in the past in Fire Walk With Me. And most of it is gone. Most of it is cut. So contextual, but the looking directly at the camera, looking directly at Laura and saying, don't take the ring. But then all this other stuff with the little man and how, you know, where am I and how can I leave and all that stuff. It's like, oh, this is after season 2. This is after he's trapped in the lodge.
Yeah, I think I get that to some degree, or at least the implication from the theatrical cut, because there is that whole bit where when we do see the little bit of that scene, it's when we also get that moment of Annie who like kind of flashes into Laura's room and it's like, okay, so that kind of places us in time a little bit and so on. But it's much more laid out in sort of like a way that you can make sense of the sequence of events.
It was much clearer, which for David Lynch is like, really? Like it was that clear? It's like, yes, I'm in the lodge. The good Dale is trapped in the lodge and he can't leave. Like all that stuff. It's like,
how can that make sense?
Right. Yeah. Oh my God. And it's like a huge, again, it's a retcon, but it's like a great retcon and it's a really cool retcon. And I'm glad that, you know, that it does come up again later, but yeah, you have to have seen the deleted scenes for it to matter.
Right.
Season 3.
He asks so much of us.
He does.
And we will give it to him.
At some point, presumably in the late 90s, early 2000s, he was like, well, the key to understanding the stuff I'm eventually going to work on is in this vault in a French movie company that I cannot get access to and nobody else has seen.
Good luck.
I mean, it's like, I'm joking a little bit about the whole, like, what, he expects us to go look this stuff up? But it's like, to some degree, it's 100% necessary.
He wanted you to be taking copious notes.
Yeah.
Yes. No, absolutely. Yeah, it's one of the great things about that deleted stuff. And like I said, when I had that script and read it, I was like, oh, this is so much clearer in the script. This was so much. And in any David Lynch script, by the way, is usually a lot clearer. There are things in Blue I did read. And I know there was a Q&A, this video of a Q&A of him yelling at somebody at a Q&A where they were like, in the script for Blue Velvet, why would you read the fucking script?
Watch the movie.
The script is not. It's a blueprint.
I would cry. I'd be like, oh my God.
I remember I went down some rabbit hole with the Mulholland Drive script or stuff that people said was in the script at some point. And it's like, don't do that. That'll just fry your brain. It'll just turn your brain into coleslaw.
I couldn't
do it, not even because David Lynch will be mad at you. You just don't want your brain to be coleslaw. That's
right. But the idea of starting the Chet Desmond plot line that clearly is meant to come back later and, you know, leaving the Philip Jeffries breadcrumbs. It's like, okay, clearly we're going back to that later. And then when you look at the missing pieces, it's like, okay, well, we want you to remember I know that you wanted to see what happened after Cooper in the bathroom at the window, and don't forget about it because we're going to come back to it. So it's like, to me, it's like, oh, he clearly meant this to be the beginning of something, but the failure of it, that's the thing. So at the end of the day, the failure of it was so devastating because it was a financial and critical flop, and nobody wanted a sequel to it, so they were like, let's do something else.
Well, jokes on everyone. Because guess what, we all wanted it anyway, and then we got stuff. So We are coming up on some long run time, so I'm wondering if
we have gone longer than the actual source material.
Right, yeah. About a half hour past at this point.
But I'm wondering if there's anything we want to say before we wrap up. So usually we do the producer map stuff if we don't have anything else we want to talk about, which I think I'm all set with the scenes.
I think we had a producer Jared on this episode.
And you know what? When I asked Jared to be on that it was going to be like that. And I think I even told the guys, Jared knows what he's talking about, and he is going to be verbose.
I'm sorry.
And it's a thing I love about
him. We need your help.
No, please. No, that's not.
So, but I said.
Not a negative at all.
Verbose person, and that's okay. Much appreciated. I love it.
Yeah, this is great. So, yeah.
But like, I just wanted to see if there's anything anyone else wanted to say before we do our kind of final wrap ups.
I at the risk of opening up something that might keep us here a while longer.
Go for it.
Since Mulholland Drive was mentioned, I'm so sorry.
Mulholland Drive, what's up there?
I'm wondering if anyone knows or if Jared might have heard. I saw something that really shocked me today, that Mulholland Drive kind of started. We talked about these two other Twin Peaks movies that might have been made, right? But never were.
Yes.
Mulholland Drive apparently started as some kind of Audrey Horn side project.
I think I'm aware of that.
Yeah. I think I knew that too.
Yeah.
I knew it was supposed to be a TV show originally.
Okay, that's interesting. I didn't know that.
Well, what we got was the pilot for Mulholland Drive with 20 or 25 minutes of stuff that was shot years later tacked onto it.
Right.
Oh wow.
Okay. And with a lot of why do you think a lot of extremely weird meta complaining about the nature of the film industry happens about that particular film, Matt? I think that is the clue to understanding a lot of what's happening.
Are minor changes. I mean, I think if you go into the dark web, and I don't think you have to go very dark, I'm pretty sure you can find the pilot version, like the 4:3 standard def pilot version.
No shit. Oh, Drive,
yeah. And I don't think it's that different up to a point. And so, you know, up to a certain point, it was a feature length. It was like Twin Peaks. It was basically, he thought, you know, and the network thought that they were back in the Twin Peaks business and that it was going to be Mulholland Drive was going to be a TV show. So the first 2/3 of that movie with a couple of, you know, they shot stuff to insert into it. But most of what's there is the pilot. Mm. And the pilot was rejected. And Lynch went to the network and said, can I buy the movie back from you?
Right.
Can I buy the pilot back from you? And they said, yes, he paid them. He then owned the footage. And he, again, I think he went to a French company. I don't think it was the same one. I think it was Canal Plus or something.
Yeah.
Will you finance an additional like week or two of filming? Because I know now what I want to do to turn this into a movie. And so everything from like Silencio on is the new stuff. And it's interesting because you can act, if you know that, you can totally tell.
You can see it. Yeah. You can see it in the shooting. You can see it in the, it's really interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I really love that movie. I would love if after we wrap the Twin Peaks stuff, we could do some Lynch films.
Let's
or something.
Do it.
Yeah.
But I find it fascinating that it was supposed to be the Audrey spinoff show.
Right.
And I also feel like we kind of got the Mulholland Drive show with season 3.
Yes. Yeah, I think that too. And definitely, like, you know, knowing that there's supposed to be an Audrey Horne thing, because there's a very, very, very fucking weird thing going on with Audrey Horne in season 3. But knowing, if you hold in your head dialectically that like a Mulholland Drive thing was supposed to be about her originally, there's a certain kind of sense you can make out of the whole thing.
See that.
Yeah, absolutely. But that's, you know, like Robert Forrester gets a, you know, he's in the opening credits for Mulholland Drive amongst the actor, you know, acting credits. He's got one scene.
Yeah, I think it's like one. Yeah.
In Mulholland Drive, where he's standing there with another detective and they're at the car rack talking about what they're seeing. And it's like, and then that's it.
That's it. I remember
he was going to be on the TV show. He was going to be an important part of the TV show, but he's only got the one scene establishing his character in the movie.
I remember my old drummer for my band bought the Criterion release of Mulholland Drive, and it had like these weird pack-in extras with it. And one of them was this note card that was like signed by David Lynch or something, and it was like clues to figuring out the movie or something. And it's David Lynch, so like it's all shit that doesn't make any sense. But I remember like that the first one is like, in the first 10 seconds of the movie, you'll learn everything you need to know to understand the movie. And like the first 10 seconds are a fuzzy shot of somebody collapsing onto a bed. Like that's the only thing that happens. It's like, come on, man.
You have a writing degree. Figure it out.
It's not his job. Well, why did you look at the note card? Watch the movie. Right.
We should do Lynch movies after this. That would be very fun for me.
I'm
into it. Let's do it.
I'll listen to you be mad about Inland Empire for like 3 hours of recording.
I am not a Laura Dern fan. And I know this is not a popular opinion. She annoys me. I don't understand her popularity. I will be able to, I'll for you guys, I'll suffer through it. But come on.
Thank you, Colin. That means something
when
to
they
me
have
personally.
Oh my god, never mind. I'll wait.
It'll be a much deeper conversation when we get to season 3.
It's going to be a very long conversation when we get to season 3. Jesus Christ. Okay, anyway. All right.
I'm excited to get to season 3. That's cool.
That's what I was gonna say. So finally, this has been a long time coming, but we're finally in the advent of season 3. The next time that we meet, we will be talking about season 3, episode 1, which is, and I'm wondering if we should do episode 1 and 2 together, because
that's how it aired. I think
that is how it aired.
But but that's a conversation for off air that we've gone on. Jared, is there anything you want to plug before we go?
I'm always doing stuff, and it's funny because when you brought it up at the beginning, it's like, God, I am jack of all trades. Like, I am all over the place. It's like,
you really are, but it's great.
Is he a screenwriter? Is he an actor? Is he a voice actor? Everything. Is he a director? Make up your damn mind, kid.
Don't make it up. It's great.
No, I guess if we're plugging, I have jaredrivet.com, which is just my website, and Ape X Mecha Ape New World Order. should be out really soon because they want to have it out. It's an Asylum mockbuster, and they want to have it out to run alongside Godzilla X Kong New Empire. That comes out at the end of this month, which is a really fast turnaround for what we shot. And believe me, this was like the first time I was cast as a lead in something, and it was like out of nowhere, as far as my impression of it was. So I'm really looking forward to it, and our big star was the great Sean Young.
Wow.
You know how they always put like one name into, you know, so Sean Young from Dune, we can tie it into David Lynch. Sean Young is in our movie as the big name, but it'll be
kooky. Wait for this movie.
It'll
is there
kooky,
gonna be
so many
fun.
Questions about that experience. Probably. I'm sure you will not answer on mic.
That's about it. I'm sure there will be. I mean, I'm sure they always run them theatrically, at least in LA.
I will go. I will be there.
Oh, great.
So I love them.
But thank you for letting me plug that. And it'll be fun. It's the third ape movie. So you know, go back and watch the other two first.
Are we going to be able to understand the rich lore if we don't touch the first two entries in the series?
Unlike Fire Walk With Me, yes.
Right. Ape X Mecha Ape, the missing pieces. I'd watch that too. I don't care.
If we had time to shoot Missing Pieces on the schedule that we had for Ape
that was a fast turnaround.
It was super fast. It was super fast. So thank you for letting me plug that. And jaredrivet.com, and I'm on Twitter and my Instagram and all that stuff.
Thank you so much for joining us.
This was a blast.
I've been wanting you to be on for a while, and I knew when I started talking to you about it, I was like, it's got to be the Missing Pieces. We had that lengthy conversation about it that time, and I was just like, I can't, like, it has to be.
Thank you.
So excited to have you guys, to have you on, and this has been so good. Such a good way to come back to the show, because we did take quite a hiatus, so we're back now. I'll just plug again very quickly, Drunk Monkeys, Pop Culture Issue will be in April. We are open until the 15th. Hopefully this will be up before then. If you have pop culture writing, please send it to us. We would love to see it. And check out the Cherry Dress chapbooks releases. I will be announcing another title soon, and I'm a little excited for it. Otherwise, I say we go. So I have been one of your hosts, Colleen Carney-Hepner.
I've been your other host, Jared Rivet. been the other one. I'm Chris Pruitt.
And Jared. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you. Bye.
When we were at Amityville apartment, there was that voiceover you did, and I sat next to Pat, and he was like, "That's Jared." I'm like, "I know." You think I didn't hear Jared's voice?
Yeah, I did.
I try to hype everyone. You know what I mean?
I'm trying to hype. You know, it's, I guess we didn't really sell that the way we could have. So not only am I in a fucking asylum movie, but I'm in an Amityville movie that's brand new
apartment
as well.
Something else.
It's like, it's, well, I don't know what the trifecta would be. What else would I need to be in?
A third weird thing.
Yeah, it's gonna, because it's like, oh, a Tubi Amityville movie, an asylum movie, and then there's gotta be like some third like crap thing.
The Amityville
that's called
thing
trauma, I guess. Is trauma still a thing?
Trauma.
Yeah. Or a full moon. Right.
Yeah, yeah.
I need a Puppet mentioned? Master 17 or something.
You know what I meant to mention and I forgot? That it was a real whiplash to watch this because I just watched The Chase. I just went to The Chase.
Oh, right.
And Ray Wise is the dad in this.
That's right.
He's like, "I need my daughter back." I'm like, this is weird.
Oh, the Charlie Sheen.
Christy Swanson.
From Cinematic Void screened it. And I made a shirt. And then the director was there and he was like, "I want that shirt." So I made him one. Because he lives like 4 streets down from me. So I just dropped it off there. And I was like, I feel cool. So it was very cool, but I was like, "Ah, it's Ray Wise," and I was like so excited. But it was funny to watch this because I was like, "Oh yeah, he was a dad in that too."
That's
but
right.
A better one.
Yeah, everybody.
I need my daughter back so I can be a huge creep to her.
It's wild how for like 5 years, 6 years, all the Twin Peaks cast members worked steadily.
Yeah,
it petered out, but I've been doing an X-Files rewatch, and I just watched one Richard Boehmer was in.
Oh.
But I mean, I don't know if you guys are aware of this, but like as you go through Twin Peaks, the first few seasons of Twin Peaks, it's like everybody. Michael Horse is in an episode of X-Files.
Mm-hmm.
Little Mike Anderson is in an episode of X-Files.
I remember that one. That was
Wyndham Earle is in an episode of X-Files,
right.
Playing a very Wyndham Earle-ish character.
Yeah.
It's wild. Wyndham Earle, in the Wyndham Earle episode of X-Files, he brings up haloperidol. I shit you not. He actually brings up the drug that
he was talking about. Yeah.
And
oh
it figures
God.
Into season three really, really heavily as
that's
well.
So funny.
But yeah, I just watched the Richard Boehmer episode, and he's the head of a plastic surgery.
Right. I do remember that my mom was a big X-Files fan, so I watched every one of them.
Yeah. Major Briggs played Scully's father.
Yep, yes, he did. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's crazy. They were all clearly huge X-Files, Twin Peaks fans, because they had all those people are show up.
Show.
And then Duchovny.
Well, you would have been, right? Anyone making TV would be like, "Oh, we can do TV like this now?"
Right.
When Twin Peaks came out. So
yeah.
It was a huge influence. And then you've got Duchovny.
That Twin Peaks walked so X-Files could run. We said that.
That's right.
But Sarah, I always forget, Grace Zabriskie. She was in My Own Private Idaho, and every time I rewatch that, I'm like, oh yeah, she like tries to pick them up to like fuck her, and then he passes out, and she's like, okay, she's like all rich and have like crazy clothes. I'm like, I forgot that was her. So
right, yeah, no, they all worked. It was really interesting. Even fucking James. James had a little bit of a career.
I like how
you know what's good about the missing pieces? Very little James.
Very little James.
So little James.
That's
He pulls up and he pulls away, and that's it.
Yeah, it's so good.
All mentioning it.
You know what we didn't talk about is that terrifying scene
where he's just staring at her in the bush.
Yes!
Oh, God, that is so upsetting.
We didn't talk about that.
Oh, my God, that scene is terrifying.
It could be the
terrifying.
Bumper.
Yeah, Matt, stick this in right
now.
That is like David Lynch gold, that scene. It's so scary.
And it's
scary.
Like, is he seeing her?
Does he see her? Does he not?
Does he see her and he's letting her go because he knows what's going to happen later?
Yeah.
Of course, it's something like
we're
that.
Stupid.
God, that scene is so good.
You know why I skipped over
upsetting.
It? Because James is in it and I didn't want to talk about it.
I mean, what's so the thing that's fucked up about it is it's like, it's completely abstracted here in like in the missing pieces, right? I know how this story ends. I know that she does get murdered by this man, but still when he sees her there and I know it's not happening then, I'm like, this is fucking freaking me out.
I'm so freaked out right now. What's going to happen?
But it's like, it's a primordial childhood lizard brain thing.
Totally.
You've hidden from your parents, or you've hidden from an authority figure, and you're like just kind of hoping they can't see. When he looks
I've also hidden
and Ray is doing that face too. Oh my
God. I sent, you know, the part when he looks out the window?
Yeah.
I sent that to my neighbor. She got she did a photo shoot for her birthday. And I was like, you gets a bunch of wigs in the mail. Me. And then I was watching to tell her that like they were getting rained on. She was like, oh my God. Like, it's like have the this goofiest reaction.
That is, you know, anything aside, that is the goofiest shot in Firewalk with Me. That slow-mo
funny,
shot.
But I love it. Yeah. I use it all the time for like meme purposes.
So kooky. So all kooky. Right. But yeah, I'm bummed that we didn't bring that up. That's
we'll fix it in post.
Theme song. There's always like something. Like one time we went on and on about something else for Vanderpump Rules, I think.
It was
during the Scandaball.
Yeah. That was a year ago yesterday.
Yeah. Oh Jesus.
Yeah. Wow. Can you imagine? Yeah. I went out and I said to Fritz, I'm so sorry, I forgot this very important anniversary. And he was like, what are you talking about? And I was like, the Scandaball happened a year ago today. He was like, I don't remember that. Well, you should.
He's like, what are you talking about? Yeah.
That's pretty much our whole relationship. What are you talking about? Either me
it's
or
almost
him
like
thing.
Those are my tasting mustards, but go right. on, I guess.
All right, guys.
All right, Jared.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
This was a blast.
I'm going to finish reading this and I'll bring it back. I'll bring it to trivia.